Thank you.
Yes. Very excited. So the goal tonight is Heather's going to give you an overview of what is a coop and a cog, where are we in the process, and then get any comments and input you have. But the main focus towards the end with the city attorney, and Heather's going to be talking about the council's role in these things. And then our specific ask is that we're allowed to interview the Public Safety Committee as representatives of the City Council to get additional work done, which will then be brought back to the full council for final approval. So that's the ask at the very end. So that is a brief overview. Go ahead and turn it over to Heather.
Thank you. So I want to go through a few slides just to kind of get our minds wrapped around what we're talking about, continuity of operations, continuity of government. Why would we need to do this, what we do? I find pictures tend to be a little better approach. And then we'll roll into some aspects of the plan, talk about one of the key components, which is essential functions and what that means for government. What are some of the dependencies? And then what goes into this plan, and then kind of where are we at and what do we need from council to continue to move forward on it? So looking at just some quick examples here, things like a city hall fire. Not too long ago, we had an unplanned evacuation of the city hall, and that could have turned into something where we would need to do operations differently. Another example is suspicious package. So these are all real life situations that have occurred that cause disruption to normal operations of government. Civil unrest, Ferguson City Hall, that was a very long duration approach. Water damage, water pipes breaking or flooding situations will cause a disruption. Protests, I know Kirkland is a very nice, wonderful place to live, but sometime there could be a protest that would disrupt the situation. Active shooter is one of the big topics that we hear a lot about now and become a very big reality that would definitely cause a disruption to operations at the facilities. A line of duty death is another example of where things may shut down for a day or 2 days or something like that situation. An FBI raid is always one of those interesting times when things would have to shut down and occur, usually with no notice. And then my favorite one here is the possibility of bed bugs in City Hall and the need to fumigate and address those issues. So it doesn't have to be the catastrophic earthquake that we had. I think prior to this meeting, there was a little line of succession action going on with running a meeting. So it's just a good reminder that day to day, these types of things can happen. So the other challenge I want to, or reminder I guess I want to put there, is the challenge associated with emergency planning. It's not a clear linear line. There are several different plans out there that all come together and interact and connect, and it's a complexity. COOP, COG, continuity of operations, continuity of government, is one piece of that complex mix of planning. And one of the approaches we've been taking here in Kirkland is making sure it complements the Comprehensive Emergency Management Plan, the Kirkland 2035 plan, the emergency operations, and all these different pieces of it to make sure that it's part of the suite rather than a standalone, non-coordinated document. So for clarity on what COG and COOP means, continuity of government, as defined through the Federal Emergency Management Agency associating with these plans, is the legal or statutory requirements that you have to maintain your status as a city. There are certain things under the Washington state law in order to be incorporated and be a city that you have to do. And so when we talk about continuity of government, that's really what we're addressing, is what are legal statutory requirements. When we talk about continuity of operations, it's kind of the rest of the stuff. It's the things that support the continuity of government. It's the things that are critical to the community that we serve, but they are not bound by legal requirements to do them. They are the right thing to do, or they are the things that we do to support continuity of government. So what we say in this is that COG is the what and COOP is the how. So what do we do and how do we do it? And to help reiterate this point, because this is kind of one of those pieces that people ask most questions about, continuity of government, an example would be, there's a law that says we will arraign detainees within 72 hours. The continuity of operations is, in order to do that, we need a room, we need a judge, we need an attorney, we need a clerk. Another example is, continuity of government is we will pay employees. The operation side of that is, if we can't do it electronically through normal operations, do we have hard checks that we can actually write out or print out and create and deliver that? So it's two sides that come together to create that component that keeps things running and keeps us functioning as a government, as well as a business, if you will, in operations. So some examples of when COOP, continuity of operations, may need to be initiated, may to have efforts. things like an explosion. This could be a gas explosion like we saw a few years ago in Greenwood neighborhood of Seattle, or it could be a bombing situation. Biological, many years ago, about 10 years ago in 06, we did a lot of planning around pandemic flu and the continuity of operations if we have a health issue or crisis. There's technology. One of the things we've found through this process of the last few months is the city is absolutely dependent on technology. If we had a cyber attack, if we had a virus approach, that would cause a major disruption to operations. Active shooter and terrorism are the human-caused situations that could create it. Infrastructure failure. The power goes out. If the water main breaks, those are both going to disrupt how our departments are able to do their business. And then, of course, we have the natural disasters. When we look at the consequences of those, everything from earthquake to landslide to flooding, and being more than just a disruption, like we tend to see with our 1 or 2 day snowstorms, these become much more longer term adjustments to business. So when we talk about the continuity of operations, continuity of government, there's kind of two different factors to it. One factor is the scale of the effect, what's happening where. So when we look at it, it could be as simple as one facility, City Hall or the Justice Center has a failure or a problem, or one department is impacted. It could be a localized situation, a major water main break, or an infrastructure issue that affects the entire city. And then the worst case scenario is that it is the regional widespread catastrophic earthquake, major long-term snowstorm, things that affect the whole region and disrupt the services that actually would then service the city, causing a wider disruption. The other side of it is we look at the timeline associated with the disruption. If it's something fairly simple, maybe a network failure or water main break, we may be able to adjust that in a few days. Working up to if it's a structure fire in a building, it may take months to clean up, recover, and rebuild, or again, that catastrophic earthquake. So we look at our timeline as being the disaster occurs, there's those short impacts, but then how long is it going to take for us to be able to reestablish or get to back to business, because that will directly affect what COOP activities need to occur. With that piece, we also look at our threat risk assessment. And this was one of the first things that we asked the departments to do, was to weigh in on Kirkland and what is likely to happen here. One of the things we took off the list was hurricanes. We thought we were pretty safe not worrying about that one. And then we looked at the frequency. So although we are at risk for a major earthquake, the frequency of it occurring is somewhat limited versus other things like windstorms, snowstorms. And then we look at the impact. And what we try to do is be able to create a document that will address the high frequency, low impact situations, as well as the low frequency, high impact. So it's a flexible resource that can be applied across many different situations. So the key of this is understanding what an essential function is. And again, this is coming through FEMA as their guidance from the federal to the state to the local level for planning. These are the functions that must occur regardless of what's going on around us. Some of those are continuity of government because they're required by law or statute. Some of those may be that you all decide it is a critical essential function that you want to continue no matter what. Some of them are simply support to other areas. So we know in our IT department, they are critical to all the other departments. So even though there may not be a legal requirement, we know that they are an essential function to keep things functioning. The key with these essential functions that we're looking at for this phase of this planning, and I say that because this can take many phases, is the first 12 hours. What must we do to maintain city government and to maintain services to the community for life, safety, and emergency need in those first 12 hours? And we give that a title called an RTO, Return to Operation. It's not to say that in 12 hours every fire station is going to be up and running full speed, but it's to say that whatever the RTO we identify, the return operation time, that service will in some form or another be back to starting. So maybe one station will be up, and over 12 hours we'll get two up, and then so on and so forth. So the goal behind the essential functions is we don't interrupt for more than 12 hours, and with that we put a return to operations goal of getting things moving forward. The minimum goal we tend to put on things is 2 hours. A lot of departments said, well, no, this is immediate. Well, we know after a major situation, we have to assess. We have to assure that our personnel are safe. We have to, you know, identify, is it safe to even drive on roads? So we need a little bit of time to do some things. If we return to operations sooner than our target goal, that's wonderful. But we know that we have to be realistic with our expectations, that we have to think about safety and capability first. So basically, essential functions enable the organization to provide those vital services, to maintain the civil authority, the life safety, and then the one people don't always think about is the industrial economic base. Because a city does have to have an economic base in order to stay functioning and stay a part of that. So it is something that we do consider when we look at continuity of operations. Pretty much everything else that doesn't fit into that category is what we consider non-essential. That does not mean they're not important. It does not mean we're not going to look in how do we get those back online. But what we're looking at is what are the initial key things that within the first 12 hours we need to make sure at least moving towards establishing and sustaining operations. Here's some quick examples from the document that we're drafting here going on. You know, one essential function is providing medical care to those needing medical assistance. That seems pretty simple. Just-in-time training for employees and volunteers. That's from a risk perspective. It's from, you know, making sure they're safe before you send them out there. It needs to be done. Non-essential examples would be crime prevention in schools and neighborhoods. Important, but in the first 12 hours following a major incident, probably not the first thing we're going to try and reestablish. There are some gray areas in this based on the type and the timing of the incident. So the example would be payroll for city employees. If the disaster were to happen on the 6th of the month, that would definitely put that into a top priority because the employees probably will need their money in 2 days to be able to manage and address and handle their own personal needs. If it were to happen on the 9th, it would be less of a priority because we have a couple days there to adjust and figure out and work through it. So just kind of understanding there are flexibilities in this. It's not hard, black and white, simple. There are some gray areas, but that's part of what we're trying to build with this flexible, adaptable approach to it, is that we can address those at the time of the incident. With all of this, there are dependencies. It's not just simply about operating or not. And one of the biggest dependencies we have is people, whether it's our staff internally, whether it's our partners' approach to that. We have facilities. Most of our departments do not have alternate facilities identified because we need to make sure that those facilities are actually safe and appropriate for them to go to. Records are another piece that they're looking at. Kirkland is a very paperless approach to operations, but when networks are down and printers aren't functioning, there's some hard copies that we'll need to approach, and we're going to have to just accept that for this plan, we're going to have some trees and we're going to have some paper copies. IT tools, as I've already mentioned, we are dependent on technology, and technology is one of the key partners here, making sure that we're trying to build redundancy. The financial aspect, how do we continue to pay employees? How do we continue to collect taxes? How do we continue to do the financial business that needs to occur? And then looking into our partners, our vendors, our contractors, who do we work with? These are all the different aspects that I've asked the departments to take into consideration based on their essential functions and really draw out that key information and consolidate into one location for ease of use and thoughtful process. So people, I'm part of emergency management. I have to say this. One of our goals is to get everybody personally and professionally prepared for an emergency or a disaster. So that's another challenge that we've taken back to our continuity planners, is to talk with the departments about, are they prepared? Could they take their work area and go to another work area and be productive? Or are there things that are specific and unique to their environment? This brings in the concept of go kits, which is something that the departments are now starting to look at. If they had to pick up and leave their normal operations, what tools, what equipment, what files, what resources would they need to take with them to be able to continue business and operations? And we put those into what we call go kits. So these are all different aspects that go into the dependencies associated. The critical topics associated with continuity of operations, continuity of government, is really about defining what is an essential function. Not that what we do on a daily basis is not important, but when the crisis hits, what are the core key things that we need to sustain? Who is essential? Again, all of our employees are valued and necessary on that daily approach, but when it comes to a disaster situation, who must we have for decision-making and technical expertise to be able to continue operations? And then looking at the department specifically, they're looking at their plans. Do they have workaround plans? Do they have alternate process plans? Do they have the supplies and the resources necessary to be able to implement those alternate work plans? So over the last few months, just to give you a review of where we've been, what we've been doing, I started in May, and I was able to leverage the director's retreat session to be able to lay this all out, very similar to what I've done for you, for all the department directors, to kind of understand, kick it off, and get where we're going. They all identified a planner for each of their departments, and I've been working with those planners to develop this resource document that's here. This is roughly what the COOP is going to look like when we get to that. They've been working on identifying all of those dependencies, those critical aspects, those key staff, and those points. Last month, we started putting it all together, laying it out, getting all the resource documents that support this, copies of delegations of authorities, copies of policies and procedures that are key and critical to COOP, so that we have one resource, one location, one place to work forward. The goal in August is to work with all of you to get your feedback, input, and direction to be able to finish this out, finish out the council section, get the last few documents, clean it up, make it look pretty, and bring it back to you for final review and approval at a future date. The components of this plan, just a high level for you, there's a base plan that is all of the kind of the meat and potatoes of it, the order of succession, the essential functions, the acceptance and resolution by the council, planning, that piece there, kind of how we do this. The appendix section is each department has done their own planning and effort and input and paperwork in there. And then the annex section is all of those policies and delegations and all of the standalone documents that correlate to this. So that, again, we have it in one holistic approach and placement. What I would like to request, as Kurt already kind of mentioned, is there's a gap in the information flow because I don't know all the details of how your council works, so I'd like to be able to work with a couple members of the council, whether it's Public Safety Committee or otherwise, to talk with you, find out those pieces, put together the council appendix, return it back for you to review and approve and agreement on that. And then any other feedback you have to offer on where we've been, what we've been doing to that point. Through this process, we found some, I'll say, opportunities in the legislation to clarify, to move forward and take some approach on that. And so I've been working with Kevin Raymond on that approach, and he's got some different drafts that he's brought forward to have discussion about to make sure that this is a holistic, complete approach.
If I could just clarify, our goal, because we want to do this in August, is not that we have to have a public safety committee meeting, but that Heather would be able to reach out to each member of the public safety committee and at a time that works for you and is convenient, and then she can interview you, have the same interview with each of the three of you, and then bring that back to the full council.
So. Mr. Arnold.
Well, I think the public safety committee members are a good set to go forward with, not just because they're on the public safety committee. We've got overlap with most of the Public Works Committee as well, which I think is a big part of what needs to be thought of for the COOP. So I'm okay with the suggestion of interviews of the Public Safety Committee.
Other comments on that? I think we're all okay with that suggestion.
Are the committee members okay with that?
Committee members. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Kevin?
Thanks, Heather. Mayor, Council, City Manager, staff. Three things I wanted to cover with you, and again, just a reminder of no action items tonight, just looking for questions, comments, feedback, direction from the Council. The first, it's not a document you have in front of you, but when you're ready to adopt a COOP-COG plan, we'll have prepared a resolution for you that will outline the basis for the adoption of the plan. The second, that we've prepared some draft amendments to the City Council policies and procedures. I'd like to run through those very quickly. Second, we've proposed some amendments to Chapter 3.20 of the Kirkland Municipal Code related to emergency management to bring it up to speed and to clarify a few issues. And then the final document that's in front of you in draft is a formal delegation and succession document related to the city manager that we think makes good sense to adopt. It's more formal than for other officers and departments, but delegation succession issues are being dealt with in all of the departments, including my office as well. So I guess I'll start off by just saying sort of a philosophical underpinning of the various documents is we wanted to put important things in front of us in places where they would be easy to find, even if they're located elsewhere. So. For example, their Open Public Meetings Act talks about how you meet on an emergency basis, how you hold special meetings, but why not say something about that in your rules and procedures? There's state law provisions that address the filling of vacancies, but why not address those in your rules and procedures so that in the event of an emergency, you don't have to look for it. It's right there in front of you. So turning to the first document that's in front of you is some proposed changes to the City Council policies and procedures. The first issue is one that we talked about earlier, and that is what happens if, for some reason, there's an emergency or some other circumstance and the mayor's not available, the deputy mayor's not available. Who would you turn to in the absence of those two officers? And so we've suggested an amendment to the voting section of the policies and procedures that would allow for you, whether or not you have a quorum, to choose a third person to act in the absence of the mayor and the deputy mayor. And that would be an amendment to 3.12 that would authorize a council member to serve as presiding officer in the absence of those two officers.
The question second, for you, Kevin.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Arnold.
Deputy Mayor.
So you may have heard that the mayor and I conducted an impromptu continuity of government drill earlier today.
We heard that.
And one of the things that comes up, I think the language you have here is a good start in saying, you know, that this authorizes without a quorum the folks there to choose a presiding officer. It is not specific on who actually convenes the meeting. And I think in a lot of these cases around succession that we should get very specific about being able to say, okay, for the group of people that's convening to choose a presiding officer, we should be very specific on who gets to call that meeting. And perhaps it is the most senior member of the council that gets to do that. And then from that meeting, you choose a new mayor or deputy mayor.
Several senior members.
Well, it's a really good comment, and I hadn't thought that all the way through, but you're right. If in the absence of a mayor or deputy mayor, who would convene the group? I imagine the city manager would help pull something together, but it's a really good point, and I suppose you could, if you like the seniority approach, you could say that the senior most member and then just keep going down until you find a council member that's available. That would absolutely be a good approach, and I'd be happy to draft something that would address who would convene the council in that instance.
And that would be senior serving.
Senior serving, yeah. Yeah, good. Yeah, senior serving. I mean, longest tenured council member.
The challenge you have is that, like right now, we have three council members who are equal in seniority.
Right.
And so you could get into a situation where it's ambiguous as to which it would be. So there needs to be a way to resolve that.
Okay.
I'm not sure what it would be, drawing straws or something, but yeah.
I was going to make the same comment, and you might want to just say position number, right? Lowest position number in order until you get to someone who's there. So
position number would work.
I think we're solving a problem that doesn't exist.
Most likely.
You need to determine what the task is, and when you have a vacancy. We don't have a way of determining a vacancy, which goes on in 3.25. Here it says unavailability. Unavailability for what and within what duration. And that depends. The definitions that we went over earlier about the gradations of emergency is very, very broad. The requiring a policy-making decision probably comes in at some point, but it may very well, under particularly the continuum that you laid out earlier as to what can constitute an emergency, it could be well past the midpoint of that continuum before you'd need something. So I'm looking for some a little bit more precision in us determining when we have to move to emergency operations or continuity operations, and what kind of criteria do we look for? If we have a flu epidemic, maybe we can continue to operate as we normally do and focus on some particular things, and then maybe somewhere along the line the plague gets to the point that it becomes everything. That's the only thing that we do as an organization. So the imprecision of this in trying to forecast for all eventualities, I think, is really tough. I think we need to set up some gradations where we have at certain points we will move from normal operations to an emergency operation, and that's not clear in what I'm seeing here. In front of us.
Yeah, good comments, Councilmember Asher. Can I respond, or do you?
Okay. I'm just getting on the queue.
Yep.
So they're really good comments, and we have tried to start to draft to various foreseeable scenarios, and a scenario where multiple council members may not be available is different than multiple vacancies, and we've tried to start to draft to both. So that, for example, think back to 9/11. I mean, a situation like that, there may be several council members who are at a conference in Washington, D.C. and not able to fly back. Yeah. And so that would be not available, perhaps could participate telephonically if the phones are working, but not vacancies. Another scenario is a plane goes down with more than one council member, and it creates vacancies. And so we've tried to begin to draft to both. And state law addresses vacancies, and there are various statutory triggers that create vacancies. And we also want to anticipate the possibility that because of an emergency or because of something like tonight, where council members have other urgent business to attend to, they may not be immediately available to deal with an emergency or other city business. And so we're trying to think about both. And unavailability, you're right, council member, is a squishy term, but the idea there was to not available as opposed to vacant. And vacancy is really a legal term of art. And I could talk, if you'd like, about some of the ways in which a council position can become vacant. And then unavailability, any suggestions you have how to sort of describe that as temporal?
Well, our current procedures are phrased in days, calling a special meeting in days, not if we're it's not talking about the big one where you need to be doing something and you need to be exercising emergency powers now. And I there's a place where you depart from that.
Okay. All right. Well, we definitely want to get it right.
Yeah. So I think Ms. Marchioni wants to add something to this conversation, and Mr. Nixon follows her.
I just wanted to add, isn't it the case, though, that it is the city manager that declares the emergency?
It would be. One of the things that I've learned from Heather is that the city would proclaim an emergency, not declare an emergency.
Right. Okay. That's
a starting point. And I think what would happen, practically speaking, is that in the event of an emergency, the city manager would immediately begin to help the city respond to an emergency.
Right.
And then we would gather you as quickly as we can. He'd be consulting with you immediately. And as soon as we can get you together, you would adopt a proclamation of emergency that would ratify prior acts that the city manager has taken on behalf of the city and provide your policy direction going forward.
But for example, in a severe snowstorm, may not involve a council at all, but the city manager would decide, that's where the essential services comes in, who's essential and who isn't.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right, Councilmember Marchioni. That's right. There are legal reasons why the proclamation of emergency would help. For example, suspending and ratifying bid procedures, budget limitations, and so forth, and also to help set up the city for potential federal assistance. But you're right, the city manager wouldn't wait for the council to proclaim. He would begin responding immediately.
Mr. Nixon?
So, I mean, that was kind of the direction that I wanted to go to. If you look at the Open Public Meetings Act, it's very generic. And it covers agencies in which the governing body is the executive as well as the legislative branch of that government, like county commissions, mm-hmm. right? Most of the counties in the state have the three county commissioners who are both the legislators and jointly the executive of the county. And in that kind of a situation, it's very important that they be able to quickly convene an emergency meeting with no public notice to be able to make decisions that are going to protect life and property. I would like to think that in Kirkland, where we have a city manager who is the executive, that the council would have all the policies in place necessary to get us through almost any emergency situation without the council having to take any action at all. Mm-hmm. Ideally, that would be the case. Now, what I would like to see, and if you can put this together, is what are the circumstances under which, in a disaster situation, the council would actually have to convene and vote on something? What are those circumstances? I'm going to guess there's not a whole lot of them. And if we can have the policies in place to get us through all the foreseeable disasters, then that would be best. Then all these questions, like what Councilmember Asher was saying, we're trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. I mean, if the building's collapsed and we don't have a place to meet, well, then we just postpone all the business we were going to do and not meet, right? It's not important to meet in that kind of a situation.
No, we meet in the hood of the car outside.
Or something like that, right? Yeah. So, but anyway, I don't know if you've done that research already, but what is that list of things that would be essential that the council take action on in a very quick basis?
Well, one that I mentioned would be a ratification of prior acts. The second would be to support the city's ability to recover for example, from the federal government in the event of a federally recognized disaster. I think more pragmatically, the city manager and staff is going to want to hear from and communicate formally with the council as soon as possible. But you're right, having the policies in place beforehand makes the most sense. And unlike what we sometimes refer to as the strong mayor form of government, where the mayor, elected mayor, is the chief executive officer for a city. It's the city manager in a council manager form of government. So you're right, it would be the city manager who would be acting in that way. And at the same time, members of the public will want to hear from their council and from their council's mayor. And so it may be as simple as reassuring the public. That you would want to gather as quickly as you can and have something to say about a response.
Mr. Asher.
In the RCW that's cited, it talks about emergency powers, and it doesn't mention a requirement for a proclamation or declaration or whatever we want to call it. Mm-hmm. However, it does, in fact, in the context of the local political subdivisions, talk about in the light of the exigencies of an extreme emergency situation. That's when you get into emergency power kind of things. Mm-hmm. We don't have, and I didn't have enough time to go and see if there was a definition of what extreme emergency situation is, or what trips that, but it seems to me, in my history on this topic in this city, we have tried to provide as early as possible in would be what we were considering extreme emergency situation. Very clear guidance that the city manager can exercise emergency powers, and we are going to, as quickly as we can get together, after the big one. And again, this is not that continuum, but it's an extreme event. Provide a document that says this is an emergency, and go do what you need to do city manager and carry those things out that need to be done with these emergency powers, and they're enumerated in this part of the RCW. That, to me, is a clear and provides after, because all of the problems are going to crop up afterwards as to the administrivia of this. Mm-hmm. It provides the best resolution of from litigation afterwards. So that, to me, is something that, that would be worthwhile having in making sure things are moving and they're moving in the right direction. I don't see that here, though. I don't see that tripwire where, okay, what is an emergency? When do we need to do that? When do we need... part of the continuity of government, I would think, would include some provisions. Someone's responsible to go get the council because they don't work here. They work somewhere else generally. And that, to me, would be a vital function to, unless they walk in the door, they could be walking across 520, well, whatever's left of 520, somewhere along the line.
Thank you.
Ms. Marcioni.
If I recall correctly, the city manager would have to do things right away in order to get funding in. I think there's things that the city has to do in declaring an emergency for FEMA to advance the money right away that's needed.
Yeah. I couldn't see that. I couldn't see them here, though.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Ms. McClellan.
I had the fortunate experience of going to the California State Institute on emergency preparedness, so a lot of this is what we had to do in real time in a in an exercise in the community, so it was a really valuable learning experience.
You know, realistically, my guess is that if we felt that we were in the midst of an extreme emergency, we would do what we felt we needed to do to respond to the emergency, and then we would ratify those acts when and as we could. And when that happens, it's a way for the council to express support for the response that the city manager and staff have taken, and it serves those other functions that, that Councilmember Marcioni also mentioned.
Ms. Sweet.
Well, I guess I have a question about sort of that availability issue, and that is if we can be available, but we can't get here, and I don't mean people should, can we write in the ability for us to have meeting on phone, to have meeting and make decisions and do ratification for emergencies that way? That would make more sense to me rather than using, you know, first responders or somebody to come and get the council.
Right. If I could just comment, the Open Public, and you know this, of course, the Open Public Meetings Act allows for emergency meetings with no public notice with whichever members are available at the time.
And wherever you want to meet.
And wherever you want to meet, including on the phone. Okay. So that provision is already in the law.
Right.
Yeah.
And again, one of the reasons that we suggested saying that or a reminder that, that emergency and special meetings are addressed in the Open Public Meetings Act is so that when we're dealing with something, we're immediately sort of tuned into going there.
Yeah.
I have a challenge with the a council member being on the policy group. I think the council is a policy-making body, that it should be a policy-making body, and it should be distinct from the city staff and the city operations. And I think that should continue even in an extreme emergency. But having having someone other than that's going to be one of the doers in there and not necessarily reporting to the city manager and the policy group, I just think could be counterproductive. I would keep that decision-making function separate. Have the city manager, when he identifies something or his staff, come to the council for decisions and make that happen. But trying to, I think you're combining fish and fowl here. I won't say which, in that kind of a situation.
That's a great example of the kind of feedback that we're looking for, because it's hard for staff to see the word policy and not think of you.
Yeah.
But it's really up to you, you know, whether you want to be involved in that particular body or not. And so that's helpful.
And when we're looking at the essential functions, you've got here connect with the public. I would be very careful of that, particularly when the folks in the know are not going to be the council. Any kind of public pronouncements really, I think, need to be part of a public information plan and a strategy that that we're doing. It has to be very well coordinated. And if you're going to give the council the task of connecting with the public, then it needs to be as part of the public information plan. I wouldn't see the council trying to provide any kind of responses in that function in 2 hours when you've got a recovery time objective of 2 hours there. Assessments aren't even going to be finished in 2 hours.
Really good comment, and I don't want to answer or comment on things that Heather would have a better comment on, but I think when we use the phrase connect with public, I think what we had in mind was reassure the public, mm-hmm. but on bodies like the EMAT, we very intentionally made sure that the communications manager is part of that, just so that that function can be discharged in that way.
Yeah.
Sweet.
Well, my understanding, just through some of the previous work that we've done on this through EMAC, is that it, really and truly it is going to be that reassuring role, because it's not going to be us reaching out to, mm-hmm. to
right.
folks. It's going to be all the people knocking on it. It's going to be Toby. You know, it's all those people who naturally communicate with us, and it's making sure that if you read the book on Giuliani's training, they had a remarkable level of documentation about what their message was going to be, how they were going to deliver their messages, and I think that's what you're pointing at, Heather, is giving us some of the tools like that in order to both be reassuring and to let people know that the chain of command will be getting that information out and the wins, because we know about what the timeline is.
Yes, you're absolutely correct on that. History and experience has shown the community is going to turn to their elected officials looking for answers, looking for reassurance, looking for something. So that line is in there is to say, it's not the department directors doing it, it's not whoever happens to be available, but that we're going to look to our elected officials to be that piece for that community, because that's who they're going to look to. And it is in support of the Joint Information Center and the messaging, and this is what we know, this is what can be said. We will certainly be giving you tools and information to be able to stand in front of your constituents and, you know, reassure them that the city is responding.
We don't need an Alexander Haig moment. I'm in charge here in the White House.
Okay.
Go ahead. I think the last thing that I wanted to just bring to your attention as it relates to the policies and procedures of the council is a description of the state law basis for filling vacancies. And it's an interesting provision, and we've repeated it word for word just so that it's there. And it deals with what do you do if there's a vacancy, and what do you do if there are multiple vacancies, and what happens if, for whatever reason, you're not able to fill vacancy, who steps in, and how long does the county council have, and what happens if the county council fails to act and the governor has to. And it's a very interesting process. Hopefully we'll never need to follow it, and you'll continue to do what you've done in the past, which is fill a vacancy from time to time. But it's good to know that there's a process if there's more than one vacancy at any one time. And so, again, to have it right there, we've suggested putting it in the procedures.
Yes, sir. Sure.
So what is required to declare a position vacant?
Oh, okay. I'm glad you asked. There are a number of
I asked earlier this morning, so you have the answer.
Well, I was on jury duty, but fortunately, I didn't get picked for jury. So there are a number of different death, disability, conviction of a felony, recall, failure to do an oath of office.
Resignation.
Resignation, yep.
Most common.
Vacancy for non-attendance, three consecutive regular meetings without being excused, a failing to qualify as provided by law, which could mean that you're no longer a resident of the city. Let me see if I forgot to mention any. Death, resignation, removal, ceasing to be a legally registered voter, conviction of a felony, refusal or neglect to take oath of office, decision of a competent tribunal declaring void his or her election or appointment. So those are all statutory reasons why a vacancy could be created. There are a number of them.
So following up on that, in the case of death or disability, and kind of backing up the dependencies of the continuity of operations here, mm-hmm. are we then suddenly waiting for some official declaration of county coroner or something to be able to say, okay, this is really a vacancy? Or is there a mechanism that we can declare a position vacant ourselves? Do we need, is there something we could do to help anticipate some of these challenges? And same with disability.
Yeah.
I mean, how is disability defined, and do we have a role in declaring that kind of disability?
Yeah, they're good questions. The statute just talks about death and permanent disability, and so one thing is vacancies typically aren't immediately filled, and so I would think that in the case of a death, on the one hand, it would be an unusual circumstance to be wrong about that, but I know it can happen. So I think perhaps, a coroner report would be something that we would want and probably have time to get, because a vacancy is not going to be filled overnight, typically. But on the disability side, I would have to look at that a little more, Deputy Mayor. But my guess is that in the absence of an adjudication, it would be a challenge.
The thing that I'm concerned about is in the case of the extreme seismic event, where you're talking about thousands or tens of thousands of casualties, looking at saying, how do we eliminate roadblocks? If there was vacancies on the council, we know that these are happening, but we're waiting for an official declaration from an overloaded.
And someone could be missing.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
For example.
Right. You would probably get the three absences without excuse resolved before you would have that.
Oh, Toby. Councilmember Nixon, that's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah.
So what does it, let's say we have the big one and we want to do a proclamation. We have the wording of a proclamation in a draft form in our emergency kit, and we pull it out. There are three council members here. They showed up and saying, what the heck's going on? When we have a special meeting notice requirement in our procedures, although attendance negates the need, if you showed up and whether you got notice or not, it's considered adequate. How quickly can we call a special meeting, and how quickly can what would it take for us to make that declaration or proclamation? I'm sorry.
First, we do have boilerplate proclamations that are ready to go, and we would be tailored to address an actual circumstance. The second part of your question is that you as a body can't take action to proclaim absent a quorum. And so if there are vacancies, they would need to be filled, and when you had a quorum, you could take action. And in the meantime, your city manager and your city would be responding to the emergency in consultation with you. But you have to have a quorum to take action, and that includes there's not a legal basis to act in the absence of a quorum.
And that reinforces the point I said that we need, to distract the public safety function, but I think gathering that quorum here is a very important initial function of continuity of government and of operations. Because phones more than likely won't be working. Even a small earthquake, they weren't working for quite some time.
Ms. Sweet?
But it would be if phones were available or radios or whatever. You could call in that fourth member.
Yes.
We can do that now.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, in fact, Councilmember Nixon, I'm sure, knows this, and maybe others do as well. The Washington Attorney General recently issued an opinion that bodies can have general meetings by telephone as mm-hmm. long as it's set up so that people that wish to can listen in and testify. That's a different circumstance, but increasingly those kinds of ways of getting elected officials together is being is finding support in the law.
This strange thing, the first time I'd heard of it, was the Emergency Management Compensation Board.
Mm-hmm.
The RCW says that the mayor is a member of that board. So it's we just need to add that to the
list.
There's
if you drill into the council manager form of government under the optional municipal code, you find that in our form of government, the city manager is considered the mayor for purposes like that. So on our compensation board, which is, as you mentioned, a creature of state law and required under state law, we've substituted the city manager for the mayor and kept a council member, as I recall.
Yeah, I'd like to see that piece of the RCW. I couldn't find that one.
Yeah.
Okay.
I can get that to you.
Thank you.
I'll get that to you tomorrow.
All right, are we ready to move on?
Yes. Very quickly, two final things I wanted to mention. One is that we've prepared drafts to Code Chapter 3.20 that would come to you in the form of an ordinance and fixes a bunch of things that are outdated. It acknowledges that we now call our EOC an EOC. It refers to the EMAT by name. It eliminates the CAT, I forget what that's called.
Crisis Action Team.
It refers to the Comprehensive Emergency Management Plan. That's the state law-based plan that we're required to have. It eliminates some confusing language about sort of who's in charge during an emergency to vest that in the city manager. It accounts for the changes in the name of the office that Heather's a part of. It updates references to the fire chief as being sort of responsible to the city manager for responding to an emergency. It updates some changes to state law that have been repealed or recodified. I think maybe the most important thing from my perspective that it does, other than cleaning things up, is making it clear that it's the city manager that's responsible to you for responding to an emergency. I could go into more detail, but I know we're probably short on time, so I'll stop there unless you have questions.
Other question, Mr. Asher.
Thank you. On the part on the director, it says the director of emergency services shall appoint an emergency manager subject to approval of the city manager. That's a variation from the way we normally do it, I think, isn't it? Isn't the city manager appoints?
Yeah, that's I can tell you what the thought process was, and it's another example of where feedback would be appreciated. From our perspective, the person that serves in that emergency manager role would report to the fire chief,
right?
Who reports to the city manager. We drafted it that way, subject to your comments, because we know from prior experience with that it's a position that's very important to the city manager. And the city manager, I think, would want some say in that selection. But it doesn't need to be written that way. And if we changed it to conform to normal practice, it would be an appointment that the fire chief makes, and the fire chief would be responsible for making sure that the city manager was comfortable with that appointment.
Yeah, I think our normal practice, and maybe I'm wrong, is that the city manager makes the appointments based on the recommendation of the director. That even strengthens that.
Okay.
And if that's the current way we do it, I wouldn't think that we'd want to do it any differently. However you want to phrase it.
I had thought it was the flip of that, but you're right. It's a little bit of a hybrid. It needs to probably be addressed one way or another.
Yeah.
Well, how do we handle all the other direct reports of directors? Is it the director that's hiring them, or is it the city manager that's hiring
them? It's the director.
It's the director. Yeah. Although they always usually check in, and sometimes I have a role, sometimes I don't, depending on the issue. The challenge of the emergency manager position is relatively new. You just gave us a full-time one a couple of budgets ago, and so we've only had one person in it. So it certainly can be done different ways. There's other governments where that position reports to the city manager. There's governments where it reports to the police chief. Sometimes it's the public works director. So, you know, we can maybe come up with a couple options for that, because it is a sort of different entity that's kind of over there, even though you want it to be within the structure. So. But it's a MAC position, so that we can kind of do it any way we want to do it.
Yeah, whatever works.
Okay. Options.
Okay.
Sound good?
Yeah.
Okay.
That was really something that I was going to be sure to ask you, city manager, what your preference would be, because I know it doesn't make sense to write things based on people, and mm-hmm. we've got a great person, but we felt it was important that the person in this role knew that the city manager had something to say about how that job's discharged. Any other questions about 3.20?
I'm misunderstanding how the EMAT, the Emergency Management Action Team, fits with the policy group, the logistics group. That what there's different things there, and I'm not sure. I think we're talking two different things, and I didn't understand the difference.
Yeah.
So I can address that for you. So as the emergency manager, we have a representative from all the departments, and they get together with me, and they really help push preparedness and information out to the city department. So they're kind of our smaller internal city team. They're not tied with the EOC. They're not tied with the policy group. They're more of a functioning and action team that helps us. You know, if you only have two people in emergency management, you need support from all the departments to get information from other departments. So that's really the function of the EMAT team. So,
do they operate as during continuity operations?
No.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Then that's clarified. Thank you.
Thank you. Now.
Yeah, that's. I just wanted to.
Thank you, Helen.
Yeah. But I would say those are the folks we spend a lot more time training. So as an example, for the city manager's office, Kathy is our EMAT person, and we just sent her for a week's emergency communication training with Evergreen Health, so she just came back. So those folks then end up having roles.
Right?
Yeah, Kathy
Cummings. Yeah.
So they end up having roles in the other stuff, but it's not, the EMAT itself is not part of it, but generally the people who are on EMAT tend to have bigger roles in the other emergencies as well.
Okay.
Last document for me very quickly is the draft succession to delegation order for the city manager. And Councilmember Asher, it goes back to the point you made earlier about a difference between being available and not being available and being gone, I mean, the vacancy. And so the delegation piece would be, you know, if he's not here and somebody needs to sign someone or act on his behalf, that's a delegation. And if for some reason he wasn't coming back, it would be a succession instrument until you acted to appoint a new city manager. And it's a draft, and it's really, you know, in the first instance, what the city manager wants to do subject to a direction from you.
Mr. Nixon?
So the question I had about that document was, if you look at the comparable state laws and federal laws, they only name positions. They don't put in the names of the individuals. But it looks like in this template that you have, they have blanks to be filled in with the names of individuals, which means it would have to be updated or amended every time that there was a change in any of those positions. Do you think it's possible to do it just based on job titles rather than, I mean, we do have the issue right now where we have two deputy city managers, and you undoubtedly would want to rank them in some way.
Right.
But anyway, that was so. It was just to avoid the maintenance of having to re-adopt this every time or have the city manager have to re-sign one every time there was a change.
I know that, and maybe Heather, you can comment on this. I understand from you that under federal law, we have to identify who would be responsible for responding in the event of an emergency. Presumably, perhaps that could be done by title and not by name. The second piece, and it's just something for you all to think about and for the city manager to think about, is regardless of title, if there are incumbents in various positions, who would you want to be leading a response if you weren't there? Mm-hmm. So there's two different considerations.
Marilyn?
Right. So right now, one mechanism that we have is we have a formal delegation of authority from the city manager, and it has our names and it has our signatures on it. So we can prove to somebody that, yes, I had the authority, this is my signature, and I had the authority to sign this document. And so it provides a proof, kind of, that I had the authority, and yes, that's my signature. And so that's why we have it now. We have a delegation of authority, so we can sign contracts on Kurt's behalf.
A version of a power of attorney.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yep. Yep.
Mr. Triplett?
I was going to add that what Marilyn covered, but also in my time at King County, it actually was good for us to use the name and constantly update the name, and there were hundreds of people who were changed quite a bit because, you know, sometimes you just have different players come in and out, and it's good to know, did I actually delegate to that? So, example, Joe has 5 battalion chiefs. You know, the chief has 3 captains. So Deputy Mayor Arnold made this comment too. I was like, well, which captain is it, right? So mm-hmm. And if both captains have the same seniority, what happens? So you want to make sure you do have a little bit of specificity in that so that you do know in times of great stress who comes first in the pecking order.
So it's worth the effort.
It's worth the effort,
If you have to fill in the names. Okay.
It keeps the emergency management team busy, but it's important. Because we're also doing that for Code Red and a whole bunch of other things. You're constantly updating names and phone numbers and those kinds of things.
Thank you, Heather. That's the reason why in the base plan, you'll see it by position, mm-hmm. but then the attachments and the documents that we would update, we do single sheets, so we're not changing an entire mm-hmm. document. We have 1 or 2 pages that we then would list specific names for.
Thank you. Mr. Asher.
Yeah, there's a couple of things there. One, in the preface, it talks about it will be reviewed annually. We need to put somebody's name or position there so that the third person always doesn't show up. And the execution of the, I would think that we'd want something in our council procedures to also take into account emergency convening of the council. And how we would do that, there's a couple of ways, but that is not provided for right now. We're still in the days, and even in some of the vacancies, we're still in the months and kind of thing. But being able to look across that continuum,
we'll be sure to address that in the next draft.
Thank you.
Yep.
Cool.
So it's about time to wrap up our conversation. Are we through the business that we had at hand, Mr. Raymond?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
All right, so we will return for our regular meeting at 7:30. Thank you.
Thank you for a lot
of work, Heather. It's great work. Mm-hmm.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. We're live. I will go and look.
Good evening and welcome. We are back in session following a study session on the continuity of operations and continuity of government plan update. We had a very informative conversation tonight and a very productive meeting with our new team member. Heather's last name is?
Kelly.
Heather Kelly. I don't think I did a good job of thanking Heather for her excellent presentation. So, Ms. Anderson, could we have a roll, please, for the special meeting?
Councilmember Nixon.
Here.
Councilmember Pascal.
Here.
Councilmember Asher.
Here.
Councilmember Marcioni.
Here.
Councilmember Sweet.
Here.
Deputy Mayor Arnold.
Here.
Mayor Wallen.
Here. Thank you very much. The first item on our agenda tonight is under communications. It's items from the audience. This is the time in our meeting when we hear from the public on matters which are not quasi-judicial or otherwise scheduled for public hearing. There are no public hearings scheduled this evening. Please limit your comments to 3 minutes. We also ask that not more than three people speak on any one subject. However, if both proponents and opponents wish to speak, then up to three proponents and up to three opponents may address the council. So we do not have anyone signed up to speak to the council. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to address us? Seeing none, I'll declare this item from the audience period closed. The next item on our agenda is a very, very special presentation from a very, very special guest, and we are very happy to welcome State Representative Shelley Kloba, our retired council member, city manager.
All right. Thank you, Madam Mayor. So obviously her bio is included in our packet, but I just want to say that our duly represented representative of District 1 was extraordinarily strong advocate for Kirkland's legislative agenda and particularly for our Metropolitan Park District legislation. She and Senator Guy Palumbo were extraordinary in the House and the Senate in getting that passed, and so we're very grateful for her leadership on that issue and many other issues. So very happy to have her. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm trying to be reminded about how to get rid of the thing on the left.
Oh, down the very bottom.
The very bottom.
To the right.
The thing that looks like a screen.
There you go. Perfect.
Oh, oh, that one. Not that one.
The right one.
Can I help you?
Yes. To the right.
Can you believe I'm on the Tech and Economic Development Committee?
Just saying.
That's it, exactly. Thank you, Brenda. As always, teamwork is much appreciated. Good evening. It is so wonderful to be back in front of all of my just cherished colleagues. And it's kind of a relief to be back in district more permanently now for a little while. It's been my pleasure to represent Kirkland on this big roller coaster ride that my first session has been, and I would like to give you a little indication. These are my, again, teammates, crew members, Senator Palumbo, Representative Derek Stanford, and myself, and the district that we represent is in purple. So Kirkland is, I think of this as a jellyfish. It sort of looks like, so Snohomish County is sort of above that flat part, and it's some cities and over into the rural area, and then the tentacles are the King County section of Bothell and Kirkland, and the Pin Hill section of Kirkland. I want to talk about tonight a couple of, three different parts here, and one is the legislative agenda that you all proposed, what you asked for versus what we were able to accomplish. What we can work on together in the future, and the bills that I was able to pass that are some of which overlapped with your agenda and some were a little bit out of that realm. So talking about our, I still feel like it's ours, the priorities of Kirkland. So number one, you're really wanting to address homelessness and affordable housing. And the three bullet points here with the Housing Trust Fund, REIT 102 flexibility, and the document recording fee. All of those were addressed. The failure of our legislative body to pass a capital budget yet is the disappointing part, because we did have the fairly robust level, $107 million in the Housing Trust Fund, which is in the capital budget, which we did not pass. So I know there are still people working very hard to try to reconcile that. It passed with only two no votes in the House, so it was extremely bipartisan. In the Senate, it did not have that same result, and it is tied in with the Hearst decision and the legislative fix for that. So I still am optimistic that we will be able to fix that. The second part was the REIT flexibility, and of course your champion and mine, Representative McBride, had a bill that addressed the REIT flexibility, and we only got REIT 2 flexibility, and it is only until 2019. So that may enable some projects and give us a little bit of money to spend, but it certainly is not quite getting us all the way there. And then finally, on the document recording fee, Representative Macri had a great bill to take away the sunset and increase it so that it would be keeping up with inflation. And sadly, we didn't get the increase. We just got the extension to sunset. That does give us a little bit more time, and that kind of leads us to, oops, I'm getting ahead of myself. We'll talk a little bit about what we can work on next time around. So the priority that you had about sustainable funding for the Basic Law Enforcement Academy, that is a really big priority for cities like Kirkland, who have been able to hire good recruits and have not been able to get them trained at the academy. So we were able to get funding for 16 law enforcement classes in the next biennium, and it will really help to meet the increased needs that certain cities have due to population growth and other things, including the retirement of many law enforcement officers who've been serving for a very long time. And getting more folks into the training academy is going to be key to that. So another priority that you had was the Metropolitan Park District, which you previewed just a little bit. And you know, this when you went back and reviewed why did the ballot measure fail, a couple of things that were lessons learned were that it did not have the ability to customize to the size of a taxing authority that we needed, and it didn't have the opportunity for voters to weigh in on a potential increase and have it be a binding vote. And so it was a big pleasure to have so many of you come down and testify. That was very powerful, and you were so consistently there when the bill was up on the House side, when the Senate bill was up, and ultimately Senator Palumbo's bill went through. That was a big exciting time getting to put it in the old hopper. There literally is a hopper, and my grin is a bit much, but it was I was happy to be able to take something that was sort of a frustration at this level and try to make something happen at the state level for that. The Crest-Kirkland corridor has been something that I worked on since I was on the park board. And so it is very much a pleasure to be able to help out with the ask that you had as far as some safety improvements and some connectivity and making it so that it connects with the Redmond Central Corridor. And we were able to get not only in a different place at 52nd some funds authorized, about a little over $1 million to help with that project, but the Redmond Central Connector got $500,000. And lucky for us, even though those are capital dollars, they are not in the capital budget. They are in the transportation revenue package, which passed early on, so those were safe, and those will be coming. Particularly the Redmond Central Connector is going to be in the 2017-19, so you're going to be able to get working on that. I don't remember if that was the full amount that was asked. Were you guys hoping for $1 million?
The amount that you have in the budget is what we asked for.
That was what you asked for. Okay.
It's stuck to the capital budget.
Okay,
yes,
that one didn't have to have any compromise. Yeah. I'm very pleased. So we are lucky on this council to have some folks who, I'm getting ahead of myself. The 1% property tax cap was something that we would really hope to be lifted so that it could be much more responsive to our economy and our population. And sadly, we did not accomplish that. It had gotten incorporated into the budget bill that Representative Litton put forward, but in the final budget agreement, as we were negotiating back and forth, that 1% cap did not make it into that budget. And there was another idea, well, let's do a study so we can sort of prove why this is so detrimental to cities and counties to have this 1% cap. And that was actually a part of the budget that got vetoed by the governor. So we're kind of back to square one, I think, on that particular one. And I know one of the champions of that, Representative Koster, is leaving the legislature to take another job. So I'm not sure what the likelihood of someone really taking that up and bringing it forward. This is the one where I feel like we had such strong advocacy from this council and from Councilmember Nixon specifically. I know this is, it has placed a large burden on cities like Kirkland, and there is that balancing act that we have to have between transparency and accountability and overly burdensome public records requests. So the 3 points here were the things that we wanted in terms of having volunteers not subject to it, having a nominal fee so that we can try to recoup the costs that we incur as a city, and to have some predictability on fines. And particularly in cases where there's a good faith effort to comply, but sometimes a small detail has been left out. So the outcome, what we got on that, was two of the main bullet points. So again, champion Representative McBride was able to pass her bill, and it gave the agency volunteers are not required to give records under the PRA, and the state attorney general will establish a consulting program so that local jurisdictions can adhere to the best practices in records management. The state archives for the Secretary of State will be providing some training, and there will be a grant program that will be funded through a dollar surcharge on county recorded documents so that agencies can improve their functioning and their technology systems. So I think those are some really good ways to lay some groundwork so that in the future we still have that transparency and accountability. And then finally, there's a feasibility study that is going to provide a portal, I'm sorry, a feasibility of providing a portal for public records management. And so I think we also, not only our Councilmember Nixon, but also our city clerk is an expert in some of those issues. And so I know that you'll probably have some involvement going forward with your statewide organization. So then the second bullet point that we were asking for was addressed in a bill that Representative Neely put forward and was passed. And so those are the provisions that talk about allowing cities and the government agencies to recoup or to charge a small fee. And it addresses some of the overly broad requests that have been particularly burdensome, and especially when it's a request for all or substantially all agency requests. Right. That just doesn't sound reasonable. So this bill would address that. And then authorizing the automated computer requests, like the bots that are out there doing requests, they are city governments and county governments they're allowed to reject anything that comes from a bot that's the same request in less than 24 hours. So it will cut down on some of that. And then finally, there's a process that it outlines for creating a customized service charge for some exceptionally complex requests. So I'm excited about those things. I think that those will really help. And you know, our city does a really good job. I know that there are a lot of small cities that really struggle with this. So thank you guys for being leaders. So the continuing work that we have to do, obviously we got REIT 2, but having some REIT 1 flexibility would be helpful. Permanently removing the sunset on the document recording fee, and of course passing the capital gains tax. I'm sorry, capital gains tax. What's on my mind? Passing the capital budget. A little Freudian slip there. And some better predictability on the fines for government when they are inadvertently violating the Public Records Act. So I look forward to, if those are things that you want to continue working on as you put together your next legislative agenda, I certainly would be willing to work on those things for you. It was a pleasure. Let's see. So there we are. Had some nice visitors down there in Olympia, and we all got our pens from the signing. That was the MPD bill, if I'm remembering right. Okay, so then, oh, I didn't even realize. Look who sits right behind me there in the, the Transportation Committee. I was very proud of the Metropolitan Park District. It was Senator Palumbo's bill that went through instead of my companion. That's fine. The policy is what we really wanted. One of the ones that I feel like is couched in some of the work that I did here was this Cooper Jones Bicycle Safety Council. And basically that will put together this council that is going to come forward with recommendations that are basically, you know, safer roads for everyone, including bicyclists. And these recommendations are going to help cities like Kirkland that have a Target Zero policy that we've adopted to really give us some tools. It'll look at not only just the sort of engineering solutions, but also law enforcement and laws themselves from a broad stakeholder group. So I'm excited about that work. That was one that I sponsored the House bill, and Senator Elias actually sponsored the Senate bill, and his bill went forward. And then one that I think the legislature was really quite a learning experience, and I learned about lots of things that I never even knew existed, one of which being wheelchair accessible taxi cabs. And when I learned that, unlike other vehicles that transport people in wheelchairs, like the DART transit and the nursing home vans and senior citizen vans and assisted living community vans, all of those entities can obtain the placard or the license plate that enables them to park in a wheelchair in a disabled parking spot, because they're serving people who have mobility issues. So that only makes sense. For some reason, wheelchair accessible taxi cabs, who serve people in wheelchairs, were not included in that list. And so we got that changed. And so now there's an increased safety for both the customer who is challenged with mobility and trying to get out and interact in their community, but also the drivers who were having to park out in the street in order to safely get their customer in and out of their destination. So it's a small bill. It doesn't affect a huge amount of people, but the people that it does affect, it affects them in a large way, really helping them to connect with their community. So let's see. I just wanted to call out, I don't know if you've had an opportunity to see the three of us all together. We did something at the Bothell Chamber of Commerce. We have three very different personalities, different approaches, different skill sets, and yet I feel like we're a really good team. And so I just want to make sure that I give a shout out to the help that Senator Palumbo gave on the Metropolitan Park District. And one of the sort of silver lining gifts of going three special sessions, was that we got time to get a solar bill passed. And so that was something that we worked on the House side in the Tech and Economic Development Committee that I'm on. And Senator Palumbo did a lot of work over in the Senate, and we were able to get that passed. And I know that that's important with Kirkland, because the Solarize Kirkland program was very, very popular. We did two different rounds of it. And the uncertainty about the solar credits moving forward kind of had a chilling effect on adoption. And so that's an important thing for the folks out in our community and for our environment. And energy that you never have to purchase again, you know, that's a win for everybody. So he was very pleased to have that one pass. And then Representative Stanford, his bill, which sadly, even though it passed unanimously in the House, so great bipartisanship, it died in the Senate. But I think even just bringing forward the idea that all of the different members of our community should be welcome, and that the state should not be turning over information about a person's religious affiliation. Mm-hmm. And this was one of those bills where we got an email from, I was a co-signer on it, and we got an email from Councilmember Nixon, who had a couple of great suggestions that helped to shape the bill. And it does make me wonder, I don't know when you have time to sleep, because it was a very good set of recommendations, and really appreciate that kind of support. So, all right. Does anybody have any questions on anything?
Questions or comments? We must have a question or comment. Well, we'll start with Councilmember Pascal.
Representative Kloba, so nice for you to be here tonight. And as someone, I think the only council member lives in the First District, so proud of the representatives in the First District. I had a question about the capital budget, just out of curiosity. You know, we've heard a lot about the projects that it's not funding in Kirkland. Like, we heard from the governor the other day about Lake Washington Technical College and the Cross Kirkland Trail connection down to Willows. But we have this big construction project, Juanita High School, this year. And I know that that was going to be funding part of that. Do you know how that's going to impact that project at all, or will it?
You know, that is one of my assignments for myself, to sit down with each of our school districts. There are six pieces of six different school districts in the first legislative district, and to sit down with them to really see what is the impact. And certainly, you know, Juanita High School, and I have one other elementary school, Motley Terrace, that are, you know, ready for construction or in construction, and we're counting on those dollars. So I don't have a specific answer for you, but I will share that once I sit down with Dr. Pierce and sort out what that would do to their timeline. I know that when I start to think about the impact that can have with delaying their construction schedule, if that's something that happens, that will have quite a large footprint on our community. So really, it's one of those things I try to keep in mind as we try to push forward on a capital budget. Good question.
Councilmember Asher is the chair of our legislative subgroup, so I think he might have a few words for you.
Oh, yes. Thank you, and we certainly sincerely appreciate what we're coming to call Kirkland Forward in our delegation in Olympia. You were so effective, and I hit the ground running. You'd never know this is your first year. You've got a lot of good experience prepping you up for this in your PTSA history and what you've done here too. So thank you so much, and we are will certainly share with you and work with you on our legislative agenda coming up. The Association of Washington Cities just met last week to begin to put together the legislative agenda for next year. And maybe your year's not over yet. Who knows?
That's right. I would be more than happy to go back for another day to pass Hearst a fix and a capital budget. So,
but also, don't forget that we're here, and when you need that external nudge and our nudge of others, we're more than happy to help.
All right.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much.
Well, I want to say that I think that the passion that you bring to your work at your work at the City of Kirkland, the passion, the big-heartedness, the compassion, and the intellect, the state of Washington's lucky to have you representing all of them, not just the City of Kirkland. So I'm very proud of you and the work that you've done. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And I go back and forth, and Councilmember Arnold is going to laugh at me, but I do feel like this was an excellent experience because you guys set the bar as far as my expectation of how people work together, how people disagree with each other, and how they move on to the next issue and find the common ground on the next thing and continue to respect each other. And Jane, I joke that it prepared me in no way for Olympia. But I really do think that having that expectation and knowing that that's how I want to operate is serving me well and will hopefully in the future. So please stay in touch, and thank you for giving me your time tonight.
Thank you for the update. I really appreciated that her presentation followed our legislative agenda. It was nicely done. All right, the next item on our agenda is also a special presentation. It's 7B, the City of Kirkland Core Values Video. City Manager.
Okay, thank you, Madam Mayor, members of the council. I also want to say thank you to Representative Klob on behalf of the staff. She's been extraordinary to work with from our standpoint as well. So at a time as we're getting more and more competitive and the need to attract and retain employees is ever more important, for the last couple of years we've been working hard to define what is a great Kirkland employee, what are those values, and how do we show them every day, and how do we attract new people to show them. And so one of the many things that came out of that is this values video that we're going to show you, and one of the chief architects of that was our Director of Human Resources, Jim Lopez.
Thank you, City Manager, and thank you, Madam Mayor, and members of the Council. It's really my pleasure to be here tonight to talk about the core values video. The values video is part of our performance management system, as the City Manager alluded to. It's the softer side of performance management. And the details about how it fits in and how it developed and how we created it is really in the memorandum that I provided in the Council packet. But so for tonight, I just wanted to say a few brief points before we showed the video. I think the common denominator between all great organizations, whether they're public or private, are its people. And in that spirit, I think the video tries to, at its core, recognize what makes our culture here, our people, so special. This video is very much about who we are, not who we aspire to be. And we hope to use it to reward, to recruit, to communicate, and to train to these values. So it's a very strategic thing in our system. Currently, we're building it into our orientation system for all new employees, where Rob Mullen, our webmaster, are going to be working to integrate it into human resources part of the web, particularly focusing on recruitment. We're also going to build it into our learning management system, which is an online system we've recently implemented, so that directors, managers, supervisors can use it as part of the performance evaluation system. They can use it in staff meetings. They basically can use this video on demand as needed. Before we move forward, I just wanted to have a couple of thank yous. There have been so many wonderful people that have contributed to this video. There's no way I'm going to be able to thank them all. I'd just like to call out a few. First, all the city staff that participated in the video. We did an open cast call. That was an idea of the team. And the city folks who volunteered came forward to do it. So many talented people. We had a lot of fun doing it. We had a lot of laughs. They did a great job, as you're going to see. I'd like to thank Mike Connor, Dimitri and Sarah, and Inga Heitch, our graphics and video team. Wonderful, great work. Special thanks to Rob Mullen, who wrote all the good parts of the video. And he did the narration. And you might even see a cameo if you focus on a guy walking by the Kirkland Performance Center. And Terry Creighton, who directed the film. He shot a lot of the film, very talented. Perhaps most remarkably, was able to put up with me for a couple of years. Just a great job. Finally, a special thanks to Brenda Cooper for providing us the time, the resources to do it. Very grateful and thank you. And to our city manager, Kurt Triplett, who greenlighted the project, supported it from day one, made it happen, and I have to tell you, made substantive edits and contributions to this video. True story, we came to Kurt with the final product several times. And you could see his contribution if you focus a little bit on the graphics coming across the screen and the really effective way the values are contributed visually. That's our city manager. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Mike Connor. Maybe you could take us into the video, and thank you guys. Enjoy.
Thank you.
Well, I love the name of your production company, Other Duties as Assigned Productions.
We know the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And being part of Kirkland means being part of something. Something big. It's a belonging. It's a family working together towards a common goal. The goal of building and maintaining a strong community. And their strength in numbers. Strength to have the vision and ability to look forward and imagine what could be. The same vision and dedication that the founders of this city and all those that followed, that cared enough to look at this place and say, I can make a difference. And you know what? I can make this great place even greater. You are part of that indelible legacy, the rich history of success and achievement. And the key to that achievement is that we hold these core values strong.
We work hard. We work together.
We take initiative.
And most of all, we care.
When the Kirkland team works hard, What does that really mean? It means
we are focused.
We are results oriented.
We take great pride in the work we do here.
And while we are here, we give 100%.
When we talk about working together, it's that
we believe in the value of good communication and include others in decision-making and project execution.
We are good listeners, and we see other people's successes as our own. We are eager to do our share and take responsibility for our part in the collective effort.
Taking initiative means
we take chances and strive to find innovative ways to achieve the city's vision.
We go the extra mile to make sure problems get solved and that our customers and colleagues are satisfied and work gets done no matter how big or small the issue.
And we make it our mission to find the most effective and efficient way to do things.
And when we say we care, that means
we're personally invested in the success of the city.
We are focused on fixing problems and not letting others fail.
We're stewards of the city's resources by using our time well and spending wisely.
We are honest, well-meaning, and always seek to do the right thing.
And we take great pride and ownership of being part of the city workforce that genuinely cares about the people we work with.
About getting results for the people we work for, the residents of Kirkland.
And if we try to embrace these values and let them guide our daily work at the city, we hold the keys to success, not just our success, the success of this great city and the citizens that depend on us to keep people safe, to keep our infrastructure strong, to manage our tax dollars wisely, to provide a vibrant place for all our citizens to live, work, and play. And every single one of us has a role. From public safety to public works, from development services to finance. It's up to us to help make this city what it is today and what it will be tomorrow.
When we work hard, when we work together, when we take initiative, and most of all, when we care, we can keep Kirkland one of the best places in America to live, work, and play.
Done.
Oh my gosh, I love that thing.
So just a brief comment on that. You know, Jim had a chance to thank many people, but this video has actually been winning some awards as well. And to extend his thanks and also talk a little bit about some of that is Brenda Cooper, our Chief Information Officer. Brenda.
Here. We thank you very much. I want to have Rob come up for the certificate for being the writer, because this was Rob's vision. He came to me and said, I want to do a really, really high quality internal Kirkland video. And he really spent a lot of time on the production values and working through the script and how to make that happen. And then this one is, you've seen the Telly Awards before, and we have one that Mike will get that's over there in the box for the that we'll keep for the channel. But this one we actually had, say, City of Kirkland Core Values Video, Jim Lopez, executive producer and writer. And that's because every video needs a champion. And while Kurt and many other people were champions, Jim did a phenomenal job of really sticking with this. Every time we got slow or I said I don't have any more resources, he kept making it happen. So if you want to come up.
Congratulations.
Congratulations.
So thank you very much for your time.
So congratulations to all involved, and I wonder if the council could borrow you for a photograph.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mike.
We are finalists for one more award, too. I'll tell you about that.
Could you guys go back around with the council or stand in front? Mike and Rob, you should go. Mike and Rob, you guys good?
Yeah, stand next to the door.
This is very kind of you.
Can you get us all in?
Yeah, there we go. Here.
Now we can get you, maybe not all the beard.
Ready? One, two. Perfect.
There we go. Thank you, Kathy.
Kind of. Thank you.
That is what we stand.
Okay. Can you push it up a little more, please?
Is it? Okay.
Outstanding work.
Thank you.
I love that. So where is that going to be shown and posted and et cetera?
So it's going to be posted where people apply for jobs. So okay. It'll be a video that you can click and also be reachable in other parts of the web as well.
Can it go onto our Facebook or is it too long?
It's internal.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
It's on YouTube.
It's on YouTube. Okay.
So we can link
to
it.
Okay, good. Thank you very much. The next item on our agenda is the consent calendar. Before we have a motion, I'll ask Councilmember Marchione, the chair of the Finance and Administration Committee, to present the audit of accounts.
We've had payroll of $3,890,401.62 and bills of $3,481,595.01.
Thank you. So before we move on with the consent calendar, we've been doing quite a lot of work with our cleanup ordinances. It's a large body of work, and I wonder if our city attorney might make a couple of comments.
Yeah, thank you, Mayor. Before she gets away, I wanted to introduce all of you to Ellie Crossa. Ellie, can you wave to the council? Stand up. Ellie is a volunteer legal intern in the city attorney's office. She's been with us for a number of weeks now and is going to be with us for a few more weeks before she goes to Belgium, where she's going to be studying for a semester abroad with the European Union. She's a Lake Washington High School graduate, a Kirkland resident. She's been a lifeguard and swim instructor with Kirkland for the last five seasons. She's a supervising lifeguard now and is going to be a junior at Colby College in Maine, studying government and minoring in math. And she has just been a huge help to us. I mean, as you mentioned, Mayor, we've been amending the code, cleaning it up, a number of recommendations from our code reviser, and then also from Councilmember Nixon and some others that have come in from staff. And she has the knack. She's a junior in college, no law school experience, obviously, although she's interested in law school, and I think she'd be a fine lawyer. She's got the knack. I mean, she just gets it. She knows sort of intuitively how the law and the policy and politics, you know, come together, and has been doing a wonderful job for us and helping us with many ordinances that are on the consent calendar tonight and prior weeks and the next couple of council meetings, and we're also working on some broader policy ordinances that may well make their way to you as new business at some point in the future. So before she leaves, I wanted to just introduce her to you and acknowledge her fantastic work, and she's just been a delight to have, and we'll miss you, Ellie, and thank you so much for stepping up and being willing to help this summer. It's been wonderful.
Thank you, Ellie.
Thank you.
Thanks for all your hard work. And watch, all those hours and hours of work you've done, we're going to enact in just less than 30 seconds. It's going to be amazing.
Also, Mayor, one last thing I wanted to mention.
Yes.
She's also a student athlete. She rose on her crew team and has been recognized as a student athlete by the NCAA. And so she's just, you know, a very talented person, and we've been really lucky to have her.
Well, congratulations. You. We're happy to have you here.
Don't get too enamored with the EU.
Come back. All right, so, yes, please.
I'd like to move first and final reading of the consent calendar.
Second.
Thank you. It's been moved by Councilmember Asher, seconded by Councilmember Pascal to approve the consent calendar. Are there any questions, comments, or corrections? Mr. Arnold and Mr. Pascal.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I need to pull item 8D claim so I can recuse myself from that vote.
So 8D will go under Is it unfinished business or is it new business? It's new business, isn't it?
Yes. New business. Mm-hmm.
New business. Okay, done. Mr. Pascal.
Oh, I didn't have anything. Sorry.
Oh, okay. So it was moved. Any other comments, questions, corrections? All right. It was moved by Councilmember Asher, seconded by Councilmember Pascal to approve the consent calendar. Ms. Anderson, would you call the roll, please?
Councilmember Nixon?
Yes.
Councilmember Pascal?
Yes.
Councilmember Asher?
Yes.
Councilmember Marchioni?
Yes.
Councilmember Sweet?
Yes.
Deputy Mayor Arnold?
Yes.
Mayor Wallen?
Yes. Thank you very much. The consent calendar is approved. See, Ellie? Just like that. Thank you for all your hard work. That's right. You make it easy for us. The next item on our agenda is under unfinished business. It's item 10A, McAuliffe Park expansion. City Manager.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Mayor. So as we discussed at the council retreat, we have a rare opportunity to expand one of our amazing regional parks. And here to talk to you about that purchase is Michael Kogel, our Deputy Parks Director.
Thank you, City Manager, Mayor, members of the council. Good evening. The proposal before you this evening is for acquisition of the Richards property adjacent to McAuliffe Park. The parcel is actually two parcels of 1.29 acres, and the city's offer for the property is $1,672,000. We have an ordinance before you that would authorize the city manager to enter into a purchase and sale agreement via a negotiated sale or via eminent domain. The proposed funding for the acquisition is a combination of park levy funding as well as REIT 1 funding. We also are proposing that a portion of the funding come from the proceeds of sale of the Blair parcel. The Blair parcel is a property that was purchased by the city in 1999 from the Blair family. It's a little less than one half of an acre. Over the intervening years, it's been used as a rental property by the city. The anticipated proceeds from the sale of that property would generate an estimated $600,000. The property could be redeveloped for two or three homes. Prior to the sale, a rezone would be required to change the zoning from park to residential use, and staff would return to the council at a future meeting for action to formally surplus the property. The question we often get asked is, how does acquisition of such a property fit with our overall park acquisition strategy? As you might recall, at your council retreat in June, we did spend some time talking with you about the overall strategy for acquiring parklands in our community. I'm not going to go over everything that's on the screen there, but I did highlight that we did speak with you about this particular acquisition as being one of the key components of our acquisition strategy as we look to preserve open space and create more park opportunities for our community. There's still several other strategies that we intend to employ, including looking for additional land on Finn Hill and meeting some of the other goals that are identified in our adopted PROS plan. So in summary, we're proposing acquisition of 1.29 acres, the Richards property, to expand beautiful McAuliffe Park. For $1.672 million, a funding source, a combination of park levy, REIT 1, and proceeds from the sale of the Blair parcel. And the recommendation from staff this evening is to adopt Ordinance 4590.
Thank you very much. Any questions or comments for Mr. Kogel? Yes, please, sir.
Madam Mayor, I would move Ordinance 4590, authorizing the city manager to execute a real property purchase and sale agreement for the Richards property, if possible, and if not, authorizing the acquisition of that property for park purposes by appropriate eminent domain proceedings in the manner provided for by law and providing for the cost of property acquisition.
Second.
Thank you. It was moved by Councilmember Asher, seconded by Councilmember Sweet to approve Ordinance 4590. Is there any discussion? Mr. Pascal.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I just wanted to say that really appreciate staff kind of following this along over the years and finally, being able to make this move and use this opportunity to make this purchase and expand this park. I think these are the types of opportunities that we look for, particularly for parks like this where there's or parcels like this where there's open space, trees, other things of real benefit, I think, to McAuliffe Park and maybe our future plans for the park as well. So. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other comments? Well, I'd echo my thanks and good work on this. So the question is on the motion. It was moved by Councilmember Asher, seconded by Councilmember Sweet to approve Ordinance 4590. Ms. Anderson, the roll, please.
Councilmember Nixon?
Yes.
Councilmember Pascal?
Yes.
Councilmember Asher?
Yes.
Councilmember Marcioni?
Yes.
Councilmember Sweet?
Yes.
Deputy Mayor Arnold?
Yes.
Mayor Wallen?
Yes. Thank you very much. Ordinance 4590 is approved. Next item on our agenda, thank you, Mr. Coble, is item 10B. It's also unfinished business. It's animal services. City manager.
Okay, thank you, Madam Mayor. So as the police chief is approaching, a little bit of logistical information. We have one presentation for the next four pieces of legislation. There are three ordinances and one resolution. So the chief is going to cover each of those in this presentation, and then we'll ask you to take them up one at a time. One thing I want to highlight is you have substitute ordinances, one substitute ordinance and a change to the fee schedule in Exhibit A. And I want to just say briefly why that was. And having the council members review this, particularly Deputy Mayor Arnold and Councilmember Nixon highlighted a couple things. The first of which is there are some things in the fee section that only apply if you run a shelter. So when we adopted King County's fee structure, things like having a euthanasia fee or a boarding fee are not things that we would actually do. So we're striking those, and so that's why you have an attachment A that's different, and the changes are clearly highlighted so you know what's in the substitute. There was a corresponding element where we actually had a fee in the code, and the whole point of having the resolution adopting the fees was to not have the fees in the code. So we also struck that out, so the substitute ordinance has that change. So neither of those changes are policy changes, but they are logistical changes. So I wanted to highlight that's why you have the alternatives in front of you. And so we're happy to answer any questions on that, but I wanted to make sure you knew that before the chief begins her presentation. So if there's no questions on that, I'll go ahead and turn it over to Chief Harris.
Thank you very much. Good evening, Madam Mayor, Deputy Mayor, and Council. I kind of feel like this is a hard act to follow after Representative Kloba did such a fantastic job and the inspirational video.
You're right there with him. Keep going.
All right. And I don't have like a character to run through tonight or a mascot, but I believe that tonight we can address the questions and concerns that you raised at the July 18th study session. Since our last meeting, core team members have spent a considerable amount of time researching and updating these ordinances, and I really want to give the credit to Stephanie Kroll from the city attorney's office and Lori and Captain Hamilton that's sort of hiding over there. They're definitely my backup here. And you should have seen our mascot if you were here at the function last Saturday. City Hall for All. It was actually some of our explorers that were in that costume and did a great job of interacting and trying to sell the program. We're just almost close to 6 months away from enacting this. But I want to start out with the first ordinance authorizing the city to provide animal services for the city of Kirkland as of January 1st, 2018. We're still on track to hire an animal control officer on or about September 1st. I have provided one of our many applicants a conditional job offer. So she's finishing right now the psych, the poly, and the medical. All looks very good. While the training will occur this fall, enforcement will still be conducted by King County Animal Control until January 1st. We've removed the enforcement language from the canvassing provisions in the ordinance, but we have still allowed for serious neglect to be reported if it's observed. Donations will be made through passive solicitation only at this time and will only be deposited to one account. So the second ordinance adopting definitions and authorizing council to set pet licensing fees really identifies the... Did I get ahead of myself there? Really identifies the purpose and scope of animal services. As you have directed, we applied licensing to pets and not just dogs and cats. These ordinances, again, will not be effective until January 1st, 2018, but the licensing and fees are very close. They're almost exactly what King County has, except for what we're removing. We've added new definitions, such as tethering of animals, and that's coming right out of state law that was recently enacted. The ordinance authorizes council to set, again, licensing fees and fines and penalties initially by resolution, and from then on as part of the biennial budget process. Licenses renewed annually, and I know we did have some discussion about metal tags worn around pets' necks and some concern that we had there, and we will continue to be investigating and researching the very, I mean, there were some great creative ideas that came forward on licensing and microchipping. So the third ordinance, amending the parks code to allow dogs to be off-leash in designated parks at designated times. These options will be reviewed by the Parks Board in 2018 for recommendation to the council, but also reflects the current practice in the existing dog park while allowing for flexibility in other parks without having to bring the code back and be updated by the council. Resolution 5262 establishes pet licensing fees, fines, and penalties. We recommended, again, using the current fees assessed by King County, except for the fee for in-the-field pickup of owner's deceased pets and pickup of a pet voluntary release to the ACO. So that was removed there. There is, again, as City Manager Triplett indicated, an additional ordinance for your review that has been provided. And I did some research on the transfer fee question, on the $3 transfer fee. That's in attachment 2 on page 5. And it does speak to an owner who holds a valid license from other jurisdictions who move into the city would pay a $3 transfer fee and then be able to maintain their original expiration date. So if you moved in today and you didn't have to renew your animal until January, that $3 fee allows us, I guess, to enter all of that information into our system and collect that, and you keep your expiration date until, let's say, it was January. So we will be bringing back additional ordinance language and sections to future council meetings. I believe the next meeting is September 19th. We plan to provide you the ordinance language in a presentation, very much like we have done up until this point, and then receive your input and direction that night, and then amend the ordinances and bring them back the following council meeting on the consent calendar. And there's quite a bit of work to be done, so I do believe it's September 19th, and then we have both the council meetings in October, and then hopefully we'll be done and ready to go, but if not, we're absolutely ready to come back. Any questions?
Questions for Chief Harris. Mr. Nixon.
Thanks. Well, as the city manager mentioned, I sent quite a few questions in. Mm-hmm. And some of them I would still like to follow up on now if I could. And I think there was like 8 of them to start with, but some of them have already been addressed. So the first one actually has to do with the transfer fee, which is the last thing you were talking about. And the thought that I had in thinking about the transfer fee is, number one, at only $3, it probably costs us more to process the payment than what we get from it. And it creates that little bit of additional friction if somebody is moving into the city and they want to just get their pet into the system. They've already paid for a license. You know, are they going to say, well, I just won't license my pet right now. I'm going to wait until the renewal comes up. But then they're not in our system. And I think if we could eliminate as much friction as possible, get them into our database, and then bill them for the full renewal when it comes due, that would make it more likely that they would go ahead and apply for a license right away. The other type of transfer that on the explanation that we received that didn't seem to be addressed is transfers from one owner in Kirkland to another. And Chief, I don't know, does the county currently apply that fee for transferring a license from one owner in King County to another, or do they charge the full license fee when there's an ownership change, like if you rehome a pet or something? Do we know that question?
You know, I'd need to do just a little bit more research to find out Exactly, unless Lori.
No.
So I'll say what my position is. My position is that that type of transfer from one owner to another owner within the city should probably also be free. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't charge them because we want to find out who the new owners are, get them in the database, and then we can send them renewal notices when the time comes. Based on that, I would like to propose, or maybe I should just move, that we amend to the attachment to R5262. Maybe I should wait until we have a main motion on the floor. So I'll just say I'm going to propose that we eliminate the transfer fee entirely. We'll wait till that comes up. The second question I had to do with the exotic pet license fees, because there's no definition of exotic pet currently. But Kurt explained that that is going to be one of the future things that we work on in another ordinance that will come up. The next one had to do with kind of the accumulation of penalties if you fail to renew. And you'll see that there's language that talks about if the renewal is received more than 365 days, it's $30 plus the license fee for any years the pet was unlicensed. My concern was we definitely want to have a penalty to encourage continuous licensing. We want people to renew every year. But if for whatever reason they've lost a job or whatever it might be, they can't afford to renew in 1 year, we don't necessarily want it to become 3 or 4 years down the road and now it's $150 to license their pet. And so my thinking was to have some kind of cap on that. I talked that over with Kurt, and we don't know what the solution is yet. And I think it's okay to go ahead and adopt it the way it is, but then continue thinking about this accumulation of penalties and what kind of cap we might want to have.
Question on that.
Sure.
If I might.
I'll yield my time.
just to follow on rather than...
Yeah.
I thought we had talked about provisions for indigency, and that might... hit a tripwire in that we might be able to use that because we're going to flesh that out.
Okay, so that's a second element. We'll make sure we bring back some options on that.
Yeah. Okay, if I may continue.
Please.
The next one had to do with just a clarification of whether the hobby kennel or hobby cattery license was on top of needing a license for each of the individual animals that you have in your hobby kennel or hobby cattery. And the clarification I got was that, yes, that's the intent. It's the $50 for the kennel or cattery fee is on top of the individual license fees. And I don't know if that needs to be clarified in some way. I'm willing to say not right now, and the staff can explain it if people have a question about that down the road. The next one, I had a bunch of detailed questions about the private animal placement permit, which is for people who do fostering. Mm-hmm. And the answer to that one is that will be also be in a future ordinance that we're going to be looking at later. So we'll be able to dive into those details at that time. Kurt already explained a couple of things that I had brought up about adoptions. Why do we have adoption fees in this fee schedule if we're not going to do adoptions? Why do we have euthanasia fees if we're not going to be doing euthanasia? And so the substitute that we have all removes both of those. The next to last one had to do with microchipping. And this is a question I think that the council needs to decide on. All the local vets do microchipping. And my thinking was, well, do we actually want to be in competition against the veterinarians in the community? The draft fee schedule changes it from a flat $25 to just doing it for cost, whatever that is. Presumably that would be like the cost of the chip. And actually what that does is put us in an even more of a competitive situation, because now they'd be paying the city $5 instead of the vet doing that. So I guess my question to the council is, do we actually want to be competing with our local veterinarians in doing microchipping, or do we not? So we can come back to that one. The last point I had was the one that's corrected in the substitute ordinance, which is where we had in the code a fee for room fees, and the substitute moves that into the fee schedule. So that one's addressed. So really, I think the only outstanding questions that I have are the transfer fee and the whether we want to be doing microchipping.
All right, Mr. Arnold.
Question, can we ask what the staff response is?
Oh, do you?
I might have a couple answers for you. And I think in reading, again, on page 5, as it talks about pet licenses, that license does belong to the animal. And that's the purpose of having an animal license, is to be able to identify that animal and return it. So it's very possible in our administrative policies that we can apply that license, as the animal moves into Kirkland, that's the $3 transfer fee.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about necessarily the owner. And then the second piece on the penalties for previous unlicensed years, I mean, it sounds to me a little bit like DOL. So this is what happens at DOL if you haven't paid for previous years. Those are set on top. But again, on page 5 under I, it does call for the Animal Control Authority shall adopt administrative criteria for granting late fee waivers. And that language is all about unique circumstances.
Okay.
And how about the microchipping?
So the microchipping, I don't have a great answer for you right off.
Right. So the county number was just a flat number, and so we didn't even know what it would actually cost us to microchip, which is why we have the cost incurred. So we need to come back with a little more, like, whether we would do it and how much it would cost. So I think the key to note is these fees they're not mandated that we charge all these fees. We can choose to do them or not, but it gives us the authority to do the fee.
And if the shelter were to do it, then it's about the shelter being able to recoup their costs and us being able to recoup our costs if we're then charged by the shelter.
What I would appreciate is if we could do a little research into how much our vets charge for microchipping today, just to know how much of a competition it would be if we'd be taking all that business away from the vets and having the city doing that instead. And I also have a question, which the city attorney might be able to help us with, is, if our animal control officers start injecting things into animals, does that raise more liability issues? So
I'm not very excited about doing that, no.
Yeah.
could I ask a question to your question?
Sure.
I guess, because the only animals we would have the animal control agency chip would be those that have arrived without chips.
Unless people bring them in and ask for them to be chipped.
Oh, so people, so you're suggesting this would be for people who just want to take an animal in for chipping?
They want to have a chip.
I see.
But they don't have a relationship with a vet. They bring it to animal control to get it done. Hmm. But I don't know that we want to be in that business.
I
right. So
that's what happens now.
Mr. Asher?
Yeah, I don't want to be in the business of being the deceased pet place. And increasingly, I understand, I don't think if there are alternatives to doing it that we should be doing microchipping. Shelters, certainly, but do we need to have a fee if a shelter is going to do that? I don't know.
I mean, that's, again, in building your program, that's exactly one of the policy questions. I don't think it's our intent to be in the major microchipping business, but it's one of those things you might coordinate with another campaign. So you might say, come down to, the farmer's market and get a license, and we're going to also provide microchips if you don't have them. So there's circumstances where we might want to have the ability to do it, but it certainly doesn't have to be in this ordinance now. But it is a tool that we might want to do over time, but it's not a primary business or one that we want to be, spending a lot of time and energy on.
I would think that we would ask our local vets to come down and do that part of the operation while we do the licensing. So
all of this is part of the resolution, right?
That we're right. So when we get to that, that's certainly
that we can propose amendments and discuss them.
Right.
Okay. Mr. Arnold.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. First, on Councilmember Nixon's ideas, I support the goal of saying we want to get as many pets into the system license and removing the obstacles to that, and the transfer fee is one of them. And I hope we can come up with some flexibility on that. And the benefits of chipping, I think we should also have an ongoing discussion of saying what's the best way to make sure that it's very easy to make sure that most of our pets in Kirkland, we have the opportunity to chip them. So I think those will be future discussions. I have a couple of questions that weren't addressed in the revisions we see here. One is that there was a lot of council discussion about, again, wanting to make things easy for people to license and renew their pets, and talked about how do you consolidate these annual licenses with multiple pets. There's language that talks about pet licenses being required. This is page 6 of what we just have here. And it says specifically that there's no proration of license fees. And I wanted to say, does that, having that in the ordinance, does that prevent us from doing this kind of consolidation? I'm fine with adopting the ordinance today, but I think we might have to come back and take a look at it if it does. And I don't know if there's with any research since we talked about that.
We can bring back some options on that. That's definitely one of the things we want to do. We're just not totally sure everything we can do with pet data, so we have to do some work with them to come back and say, here's where their limitations are, and then if there's workarounds and so forth.
Okay.
But I'll make sure we note that one.
Great. And then the other thing in the list of things as we continue to iterate and revise on this, we define cat in the ordinance. We do not we define dog in the ordinance. We don't define cat. We should probably do both. Thank you.
Do define domestic animal. So that's, I think that was right underneath on page 2 of attachment 2. Domestic animal means any animal that is usually or commonly tamed and bred by humans, such as but not limited to any dog, cat, rabbit, guinea pig, gerbil, bird, etc. So, and then there is some language that what is not a domesticated cat. So, but we can find it and do a specific definition for cat.
We define not cat.
We define not cat, and we define domestic animal. But we can do, because I don't want to offend cat lovers and have them notice that we've put more emphasis on dog, who typically is more of a problem dog than cat. But
yes, sir.
Would those potential changes give us an indication that we should wait and do this once, or do we want to do it and then do it again?
So I think you could do it either way. I think those kinds of things we'd bring as a consent follow-up in the future, so we might have a consent that shows the definition of cat, you know, that kind of stuff. But the substantive ones, like the variations on license fees and stuff, would not be on consent. That would be part of a new discussion. But I think our guess is we're going to be doing a lot of iterations, so I think probably getting the basics in place now is a good idea, and then we'll come back with specific edits, because we'll probably always find another thing that we forgot as we do this.
Establish a point of departure.
Exactly.
Yes, please.
Madam Mayor, I'd like to move Ordinance 4591 in its publication summary, authorizing the city to provide local animal services through establishment of a local animal control authority in the Kirkland Police Department, and to hire, train local animal control officers, and to enter into third-party contracts necessary to support the city's local animal services.
Second.
Thank you. It's been moved by Councilmember Asher, seconded by Councilmember Marchioni, to approve Ordinance 4591. Is there any discussion? Ms. Anderson, the roll, please.
Councilmember Nixon?
Yes.
Councilmember Pascal?
Yes.
Councilmember Asher?
Yes.
Councilmember Marchioni?
Yes.
Councilmember Sweet?
Yes.
Deputy Mayor Arnold?
Yes.
Mayor Wallen?
Yes. Thank you very much. Ordinance 4591 is approved. Mr. Asher?
Madam Mayor, I'd like to move Ordinance 4592 and its publication summary, adopting portions of the city's local animal control ordinance that sets forth the city's purpose and scope in providing local animal services, sets forth definitions, and sets forth pet licensing requirements.
Second.
Thank you. It's been moved by Councilmember Asher and seconded by Councilmember Pascal to approve Ordinance 4592. Is there any discussion on this ordinance? Ms. Anderson, the roll, please.
Councilmember Nixon?
Yes.
Councilmember Pascal?
Yes.
Councilmember Asher?
Yes.
Councilmember Marchione?
Yes.
Councilmember Sweet?
Yes.
Deputy Mayor Arnold?
Yes.
Mayor Walling?
Yes. Thank you very much. Ordinance 4592 is approved. Mr. Asher?
Madam Mayor, I'd like to move Ordinance 4593 and its publication summary relating to park rules and allowing dogs to be off-leash in designated off-leash dog parks. Specific portions of parks designated as off-leash or in designated parks during park hours that have been specifically designated as off-leash hours, so long as the dog remains under the control of the owner or handler.
Second.
Thank you. It's been moved by Councilmember Asher and seconded by Councilmember Sweet to approve Ordinance 4593. Is there a discussion on this ordinance? I'm glad we have a framework in place to make this good thing happen. So thank you. Ms. Anderson, the roll, please.
Councilmember Nixon?
Yes.
Councilmember Pascal?
Yes.
Councilmember Asher?
Yes.
Councilmember Marchione?
Yes.
Councilmember Sweet?
Yes.
Deputy Mayor Arnold?
Yes.
Mayor Walling?
Yes. Thank you very much. Ordinance 4593 is approved. Mr. Asher?
Madam Mayor, I'd like to move Resolution 5262, establishing pet license fees, fines, and penalties related to local animal services.
Second.
Thank you. It's been moved by Councilmember Asher and seconded by Councilmember Pascal to approve Resolution 5262. Now we have discussion. Mr. Nixon.
So just to clarify, the motion is on the proposed with the substitute exhibit, correct?
Yes.
I'll go ahead and make the motion, and we can discuss whether we actually want to adopt it or not. But I would like to move that we amend Exhibit A to delete the transfer fee from Section A.
A5.
Section A5 and renumber the following items.
Sorry. Thank you. It's been moved by Councilmember Nixon and seconded by Deputy Mayor Arnold to amend Exhibit A to delete the transfer fee in Section A5 and renumber the remaining items. Discussion. Mr. Asher.
Just a question: does the staff have any input on this particular fee? I think we've talked about it. I just want to make sure that, from the staff perspective, I have an opportunity to provide input. Okay.
Thank you. No heartburn at all.
Thank you, Mr. Nixon.
So I'll speak in support of my motion. I think that eliminating the transfer fee will help to encourage people who are moving into the city or taking in animals or taking ownership of animals from other people in the city to make the decision to go ahead and apply or to get their name and their pets information in the licensing database, which will make it easier for us to follow up with them for renewals.
Other comments? So the question is on the motion to amend the original motion to approve Resolution 5262 by amending Exhibit A to delete the transfer fee in Section A5 and renumber the remaining items in that section. Will all those in favor please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Thank you very much. That amendment is approved. Mr. Nixon.
And then I would also like to move that we amend the exhibit to delete item D2, optional microchipping for pets, and renumber item 3 to be item 2.
Second.
Thank you. It's been moved by Councilmember Nixon, seconded by Councilmember Asher to amend Exhibit A to delete item D2 about optional microchipping for pets and renumber the following item. Discussion. Mr. Nixon.
Yeah, so as we previously discussed, I'm in favor of having the city not be in the microchipping business, primarily because I don't want to take that business away from the veterinarians in our community, but also because I have concerns about the skills required to properly do microchipping and whether we want the city to be taking on the liability of that.
Thank you. Other comments? Ms. Sweet.
And I'm just confused. I didn't think we were going to do the microchipping. I thought this was a fee that would be incurred through the shelter. And this is a lot cheaper than you can get it done in any vet's office. So, right. I mean, if the difficulty is that if you pick up a pet and somebody retrieves the pet, you don't necessarily expect that they're going to take them and pay the $40 at a vet's office to get the pet, their animal microchipped. I think the practice is they microchip them, and when you pick your pet up, you pay the fee. Is that how that works, Lori?
Yeah.
Don't forget your crutches.
It was a brutal dentist appointment. This is an interesting discussion because, of course, King County has its own shelter and its own vets. So the microchipping part of this ordinance that we have been scrubbing, you know, this is where we're coming upon a place where we don't have our system yet set up with our shelter, the shelter that we're going to contract out with. So making sure that we have that this is part of the shelter service with the contract that, or with the provider that we contract with is important. I don't see any reason why the city program would do its own microchipping. But trying to make sure that there is this is part of the shelter service in the contract is something that we'll examine as we move into that direction. And then also, Stephanie, perhaps there should be some reference in the ordinance. Thank you.
Sorry. Thank you. I can ensure that the future ordinances that come with to you in the future indicate that if the shelter microchips an adopted pet or something like that, and this city is charged that fee, then we can obtain reimbursement.
Recoup the cost.
Right, but we don't have to have it in the attachment to the resolution.
So I can, okay, if we do this.
Yes, I can go ahead and make sure for recoupment that it shows up in a different area.
Okay, thank you. I've got Mr. Asher, then Mr. Nixon.
And I think eliminating this ensures that we will have a full discussion if we get in anywhere close to a microchipping business.
Yeah, agreed. Mr. Nixon and Mr. Arnold.
So I just want to make sure that I completely understand what our relationship is going to be with the shelter. Because some of the discussion we're having now makes it feel like the city will continue to have an interest in the animals after they're handed off to the shelter. And my understanding was that once we deliver an animal to the shelter, it's their responsibility entirely. And if they want to have a mandate that animals be microchipped before they're adopted, that's completely up to them, and the city's not involved. Am I mistaken?
No, you're not mistaken. There is, I can't remember in the contract that we're looking at with Everett what the period of the holding period. No, I think it's like 10 days. So after a stray, for example, or a pet stray that's you can't identify by a license or a microchip has been in the shelter and no one has come to claim it, then it becomes the property of the shelter to put up for adoption and manage its next happy home.
And again, and just to be sure, do we pay a daily fee to the shelter
Not
during
a daily
those 10 days?
It's a flat fee.
We pay a flat fee on admission.
Yes.
I guess that's the right word. And
check-in.
Yeah, check-in, yes. And then we're done, right?
Yes.
Okay. And then from that point on, it's up to the shelter to be contacting the owner, any adoption fees that take place, any cost recovery from vet fees. It doesn't come through the city anymore. It's completely between the shelter and the owner. Okay. Thank you.
And I will validate, I say yes, yeah. And I will validate that as I'm working on the contract with them.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Arnold.
Related to this question, Lori, will we have the opportunity to weigh in on some policy issues on what the standards that are included in that contract? Like, for example, you mentioned that 10 days is an example that a pet would be held before being released for further adoption. You know, that may be something we want to talk about. What's the right time frame and make sure that that is set up? There may be standards as far as welfare of the animals that we would like to set as a contract requirement. We have an opportunity to weigh in on some of those policy issues in the future.
I'm sure we can propose scope of service change. Whether or not the shelter accepts them will be part of that.
There's actually language in the ordinance that speaks to how long that we'll hold animals.
Okay.
And King County's contract.
Hold them or the shelter?
And King County's contract is 104, right? We pay for 104 days, or 104 hours, sorry. And there's ordinance language about, 72 hours. And even, let's say that the shelter is going to keep them for 10 days. Our goal is still reunification. Mm-hmm. So we're still working with our residents here trying to get that animal reunified.
Right.
So whether that happens or not, I can't say. So yes, it is now the responsibility of the shelter, but people still put up flyers and there's still people, call and right. And so that reunification process doesn't just, we don't just cut them off at check-in and say, right. I don't know, I can't help you, call Everett.
So the reason why I asked this question is that I agree that we don't want to be in the microchipping business, but I do think for, as we start to think through some of the scenarios, we may want to provide incentives in the contract that say that we want to encourage the shelter to microchip. You think about a scenario where somebody doesn't have their pet licensed in Kirkland, it's picked up by our animal control officer and goes to the shelter. They track it down at the shelter, and then at that point, they have to have it be licensed and pay the cost for release. We may want to have an incentive at that point to have the animal chipped as well. And so I want to think through some of these scenarios. I'm okay with this amendment to remove it from the fee schedule, but I do want to have the flexibility to think through
in the contract
how we do this in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments? Mr. Nixon.
So there is one other thing. It's kind of unrelated, but because we're talking animal control in general, I wanted to bring this up. So on Saturday at the City Hall for All event, I had an interesting discussion with a friend, and she suggested that we integrate our pet reunification program with our social media. Mm-hmm. And for example, if we take in an animal, that we'd be able to take a picture of it, post it on Facebook, in the lost cats of Kirkland or whatever, and help with reunification that way. Do you feel as though we would need to have something specific in the ordinance to do that, or is that something we can just do administratively?
Yeah, I don't think that we need to have that in the ordinance at all.
I think we
can
assume we would be doing that
administratively. Okay. And there's some cities that have run into issues with putting animals on social
pet
media.
Privacy.
Mostly, then some inquiries is what happened to that animal, and
right.
Can you prove that it was adopted and nothing bad happened to it? So it's like it's in our care and custody for a moment. So again, that's why reunification, even after we've delivered it to the shelter, is still important.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep.
All right. It was moved by Councilmember Nixon and seconded by Councilmember Asher to amend Exhibit A to delete Item D2 about optional microchipping for pets and renumber the following item. Will all those in favor of that amendment please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And those opposed say no. Thank you very much. That amendment is approved. Any further amendments before we vote on Resolution 5262 as amended? Thank you very much. The question is now on the motion. It was moved by Councilmember Asher, seconded by Councilmember Pascal, to approve Resolution 5262, establishing pet license fees, fines, and penalties related to local animal services. Will all those in favor, as amended, will all those in favor please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Thank you very much. Resolution 5262 is approved. I think we should press on. Thank you very much, Sherry. That's yes. Great. Good work. A lot of work there. Thank you. The next item on our agenda is now new business. It's item 11. It's the previous item 8D, claims. City manager.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. So what we would need is a motion to accept the claims and refer them to staff for action.
Okay. Madam Mayor, I previously recused myself from a claim made by a personal friend, Lori Hislop. She's also the owner of number two here, Salon Featherly Suites. So I will be recusing myself.
Thank you, sir.
Can I ask a question? Do we need to recuse ourselves if we know the person? I think we're just accepting claims.
It's a parent's fairness issue. I think it's discretionary.
Okay.
So
thanks.
Certainly an option, but not required.
Okay.
So I'd entertain a motion to accept the claims.
So moved.
Thank Second. You. Moved by Councilmember Sweet, seconded by Councilmember Asher to accept the claims. And item 8D, the previous item on our consent agenda. Will all those in favor please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. And those opposed say no. Thank you very much. The claims are accepted. The next item on our agenda is item 12, reports. Mr. Nixon.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. A few things happened since our last meeting. On the 27th of July, I attended the airport tour by the Port of Seattle, and I think I was the only one from the council that made it to that one. It was a very interesting opportunity. They talked a lot about the new international arrivals terminal that's being built right now and expanding the North Satellite and all their work to protect the environment. We actually got to ride buses around on the tarmac amongst the airplanes. That was pretty cool. The 29th, of course, we had our City Hall for All event, and I'm sure others will have comments on it, but I just wanted to emphasize that I thought it was extremely well done and congratulate the staff on a great job on that event. On July 31st, I had the opportunity to take a tour of Compass Housing in Seattle with Leslie Miller and Karina O'Malley, and take a look at all the different services they provide, but especially focusing on the mail services and the banking services with an eye toward possibly providing similar services on the east side, which are available only on a very limited basis right now. So we're looking for a report from Leslie. She kept extensive minutes of that, and I will share those with you when I get them. Also, the evening of the 31st was the premiere night for the new Chick-fil-A, and the mayor and I were able to attend that event and do the ribbon cutting, and I had the pleasure, based on my more extensive Chick-fil-A experience, of offering the welcoming remarks to the owners. Yeah, like I said, there's a lot of Chick-fil-A right here. And then on August 1st, of course, last night, we had the National Night Out and 19 different block parties around the city, an opportunity for people in the community to meet our police officers and council members. I attended three of the block parties in Kingsgate, and I'm happy to report that the feedback I received in general was that the city was doing a very good job. The comments were all pretty positive. There were a few questions about traffic congestion and the progress on the village at Totem Lake and those sorts of things. But all in all, it was a very positive experience with a great turnout. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Pascal.
Thank you. So, yeah, just to follow up on the national night out yesterday, I was able to attend a number of them, five of them, actually.
Wow.
I tried for six, but I ran out of time. But, yeah, it was the same positive results. Amazing. Next time I'm going to go more hungry, I guess. I ate dinner before, so that was a mistake. this morning attended a meeting, a development project on Finn Hill, kind of looking at tree damage and kind of what we as a city can maybe be thinking about. You know, and it's kind of similar to some of the things that we were talking about with the HPO, Holmes Point Overlay regulations. And then we had the Public Works, Parks, and Human Services Committee meeting this morning. It's been a marathon day. Yes. And we talked about, you know, how to maybe some improvements we can make to service requests by the public, people that, you know, need potholes fixed or vegetation trimmed back, how they can more easily do that. So we saw some good ideas from staff. Update on the grant strategy. I think we have some really interesting projects that we're going to put out for apply for grants that we have a really good shot at. So that was really encouraging. And then a discussion about just the heavy usage we're seeing in our waterfront parks this summer. A lot of after hours activity resulting in additional need for patrols to kind of clamp down on that and make sure trying to reduce the garbage and other things that are resulting from that. The ETP Site Transportation Partnership meeting is canceled for August. Next one will be in September. And I just had a couple. I had a couple calendar or items too. Do you want me to save that for
calendar update?
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Asher.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Regional Transit Committee met after our last meeting. And talked about a couple of metro programs, speed and reliability, which is a very high priority. Once you get a route, maintaining the reliability on there is key. And our capital investments may work very well into maintaining and establishing on some of the growth routes that are coming good speed and reliability. If they can do that, then we'll have successful routes. Also, a metro in motion program that has before and after evaluations of providing it sort of at a micro level in a neighborhood area. Providing incentives, providing education, and seeing what the resulting transit ridership and impact on transit ridership is. And they've had very good success. So it may be something that we want to work with Metro over the long term and include in our transit plan that we hope to see sometime in the next year. I would hope that we get that. Just a note on the children's concerts, the Eastside Time Bank has been working as a volunteer organization and bringing out a particular note. Former Deputy Mayor Sanz Contreras to work the parking and assistance with that. It has been amazing that the there are so many families with young children that it fills up the Juanita Beach parking lot and just about all of the fields across. And it's amazing how many come out of the woodwork to go to that on Tuesday morning. Last week we had the Association of Washington Cities Legislative Committee meeting in preparation of developing the legislative agenda that will be adopted by the AWC board at the end of September. The Association of Washington Counties was there, and after their big push on 1%, you know, they hired Rob McKenna, and maybe this is why John Koster bailed. They are... they've sort of said, we've done that, we're not doing it anymore, which really is a shame. I think that is, there's so much good logic behind that, that it's on the tentative agenda for Association Washington Cities to maintain, you know, a priority issue of eliminating the 1% limitation on property tax growth. I did get our car tab increase for the, so that the first increase can be to $40 included on the agenda. There was also another, there's a sales tax provision in the Transportation Benefit District, and one of the other jurisdictions said they wanted to pile that in there. So I think we may be able to put together a, something this next year for AWC and the Transportation Benefit District. And just to round out the week, I was part of, with the Deputy Mayor and Council Member Pascal, the Governor's roadshow on shaming over the capital budget that he was out at the where our Willows Road connector would come up right on the tracks. He made sure that none of us stood on the tracks when we were taking photos because he's been taken to task for that. But he's out and doing around the state visits to highlight the lack of passing a capital budget. So I guess if that's if he's still working on it, we ought to be still working on it and still pushing for it too. That's all I've got. Thank you.
Ms. Marcioni.
I just wanted to make a few comments about Saturday in City Hall for All. I thought it was a great event. Everybody really seemed to be enjoying it. And I thought everything went very well. I want to compliment Marilyn Beard for all the work she put in on pulling this together.
Yes.
And I think it was a stroke of genius to have ethnic restaurants donate the food to see what was out there. But people seemed very, very enthused about it. The Lieutenant Governor did a very good job in his speech.
Yeah.
And I've been known to be critical of him, but he's like he's really changed, and this is something he's taken to heart. So I felt it was just a wonderful event.
Cool. I agree. Ms. Sweet.
Well, yeah, just following up on that, I really am sorry that I couldn't be here for Kirkland for All. I understand it was fabulous, and just following it on Facebook was enough to make the 98 degrees in Kettle Falls overwhelming. Otherwise, let's see. Toby, did you mention the Jefferson House Memory Center ribbon cutting?
I forgot that one.
Well, somehow we both went to the ribbon cutting, and somehow he got in the picture.
But that's what I said.
When did they do the picture?
Right after you left.
Well, that was nice. and all right, then we had our public safety meeting. Minutes are in it. I thought there were minutes are available. I thought there was something we were going to mention at this meeting, but I don't think so. We did have the indivisible response, and a summary is being prepared, I believe, for the full council. We talked about the watercraft storage. Had a SWAC meeting, which was a repeat of the week before's MISWAC meeting, but with a fair amount of conversation expressed by the chair, Garber, with regard to the process that was used for the third-party review on waste to energy. It's kind of a typical fighting topic between Chair Garber and Ashley, I think, Kathy Lambert, around whether what direction we should be taking in the long run. So it just takes up a lot of time.
Who's on our side?
Well, our side is, I think, our constituency. So from my perspective, I think we do the thing that makes the most economic sense, but we'll see how this rolls out. Cascade Water Board, we had an after follow-up from the resiliency workshop, which a number of staff attended, and I think was really well attended. I did voice some concern to Kurt in follow-up, as in follow-up, Cascade has sort of made this offer to provide for emergency training around certain issues. As an EMAC member, those trainings are available pretty readily through King County emergency management, and, you know, it's all FEMA oriented. It's all, I'm just concerned that there's a little bit of a duplication with that request. We also talked about reclaimed water legislation. I laughed out loud. I didn't think the legislature is ready to talk about anything around water. but that is an issue that the public policy group is going to be looking at soon. We had a further MISWAC meeting talking about we will probably be extending the comp plan process by just a few months to merge the finalization of the comp plan with the EIS that's going to go in hopefully at the end of this year. And then last night, I was so glad I was able to get back in time for that. I had a ball. I went to 5 picnics, and every single one of our neighborhoods thinks it's the very best neighborhood out there. And I think that just makes my job feel so good, and I'm sure it does for everybody else. It really is wonderful how much people love this city. I didn't get a lot of negative feedback about anything. What I concentrated on is I talked to every one of the neighborhoods about Map Your Neighborhood and CERT training, and, you know, the opportunities that has to sort of connect up to events like this one. And I don't know. It was just really fun. It was a great way to end the month. And that is all.
Thank you. Deputy Mayor Arnold.
Thank you. In addition to the things that have already been mentioned in National Night Out, got some good ideas for the neighborhood safety program, some of which folks had actually heard about and submitted, some of which staff will be getting email from me and talking to the different neighborhoods. And also a lot of folks wanted to ask questions about an indoor aquatic center. There still is interest within the community for an indoor pool, so I look forward to talking about that. The other thing of note is on Thursday, July 20th, I attended the Rye 87 Recovery Council, and the Salmon Recovery Council is updating the Salmon Conservation Plan, and the council itself will be finalizing that at our September 21st meeting, and they have it open for comments. This is something that once Rye 8 finalizes the plan, it will go out to the individual cities for ratification, which we will see in the fall. So I'll send you all some emails to look at the plan. Comments from Kirkland staff have already been incorporated, and the updates really include new and updated recovery strategies, updates of site-specific projects, recommended land use actions for cities, and a monitoring and assessment plan. But given that the opportunity to really influence any change would happen in September, I wanted to make sure that you all had a chance to take a look at it. I will send that around. Right now, we've got no concerns, and we'll work with staff on how this comes back to us for formal adoption.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mayor, may I bring up one thing?
Yes, please.
I've had a couple of people mention to me that they that live out in the plateau that they have been to the new YMCA, City of Sammamish, mm-hmm. Community Center and Pool, and that it's just a fabulous place to go. And it's, I think, free to families that live in the City of Sammamish. So I wonder, I know we rejected this previously, but I wonder, in light of everything that's happened, if we'd want to look at it again.
Partnering with the Y?
Yeah.
Or another organization similar?
Yeah. Yep.
Should we send that back to the committee, or do you want to bring it back? How would we bring that back?
Let's have it go back to the committee first.
Yep.
Make a recommendation?
Yep.
And find some land.
Yeah.
So
to the Public Works and Parks Committee, is that
Public Work and Parks, yes, please. Mr. Nixon?
Well, the thing to keep in mind, though, is we would still have to pay 100% of the capital costs because we're not the kind of community that the YMCA is going to subsidize. And Sammamish was the same way. Sammamish paid all the development costs. Okay. They're just contracting with the YMCA to operate it. So
back to the committee it goes. Mr. Asher.
And just a question. This consideration needs to be phased in with our public safety mm-hmm. initiatives that we've got coming up
in the
next year,
yeah.
two, mm-hmm. and a half, three.
Yeah. We've got plenty of time to look at aquatic center.
Yeah, right? Good.
Yeah, I guess that was going to be my similar comment, which is that with the new MPD authority, whenever the council chooses to take up the issue of should there be a new aquatic center, then that would be one of the options you would look at. But I think looking at that separate from a bigger issue right. about if there's a ballot measure and when it would be, you'd want to have those conversations to be integrated.
Did we put this on the park board's work program to look at? I don't recall.
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
Not in the short term.
I don't think we were ready. And we also need to track what Councilmember Balducci is doing because she's actively working on that. So she should just be maybe a monitor and think mm-hmm. about type of project. Okay, thank you. The only item I had was, you know that I attended a meeting with about the One Center City effort and buses truncating at Mont Lake, and so that's something we need to be following carefully. I wanted to add my thanks for City Hall for All. It was a smashing success, I feel, and it was something very amorphous, and you made it into an event, a thing, and it was just very well received. People absolutely loved it. It was wonderful to see all of you there. I mean, all of our staff there, just excellent. I thought the World Cafe really worked out well. It was a lovely, lovely event. So thank you very much to everyone involved. It's just made me proud of what kind of city we are. So thank you. So calendar update, it's city manager reports now, yes?
So a couple quick calendar. Short reports before the calendar.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
First, I had a great opportunity today to go to the Kiwanis as a guest of Councilmember Asher and speak to them about the city work program. So we covered all of our major topics and issues. So that was a great opportunity for me. The mayor and I also got a chance to meet with our King County Councilmember Claudia Balducci, and she also wanted an update on the whole work program. So we got to walk her through every one of our major issues and provide an update and ask her where she might be able to help, particularly on places like the homeless shelter and obviously some of the transit and sound transit issues, and she sits on both of those groups. So that was also positive. So we're getting that message out there to our stakeholders and regional partners, not just ourselves. One topic that I had is relates to what we heard from Representative Kloba today, which is that with the non-passage of the capital budget and the lack of a current housing trust fund actually allocated, we're hearing that one of the concerns from the various funder groups like ARCH and others is that the state may choose not to actually have a funding round until the capital budget is actually adopted. And one of the challenges of that, if that really did happen, is we could miss the federal funding cycle, and we may not then be able to do projects until the following year. So one of the things I wanted to ask is whether you'd be willing to let the legislative committee maybe make some calls to folks like Representative Springer and Representative McBride. Our thought was to encourage the state to have a funding round, and then if we don't get any funding, then they don't allocate. But if we wait, we may miss an opportunity here, and we think that maybe some advocacy from the local level could help. But I wanted to see if you guys were willing to let us make some calls on that.
Head nods? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So those are my main policy updates. So now to calendar.
Calendar. Mr. Pascal?
Yeah, I just had a couple quick things. The first one was related to one of the items on our consent agenda today, which was that unopened right-of-way mm-hmm. regulation. I was wondering if we could add that to the legislative agenda, perhaps. I mean, specifically what I'd be looking at is for locations where we have pedestrian trails identified on a plan that we are wanting to build, that we could at least get a pedestrian easement of some sort, like we got a utility easement. I mean, so that would be something that I'd be willing to ask the council, see if that would be something that...
Absolutely.
The second item is regarding our next council meeting, which is on September 5th, I believe, after Labor Day. And we're going to be having a public hearing on the interim regulations for the Holmes Point overlay. And after we adopted those last meeting, I noticed some emails kind of be sent out describing that a little bit about, the description was really about tree retention. And for me, I'd like to make sure that the messaging's clear when we advertise a public hearing, because I think the other piece of it was making sure that we keep these natural areas intact because of landslides, because of drainage issues, because of water runoff. The tree retention is more kind of the cause and effect. So we're doing that to prevent those things from happening. So I'd like that message to be clear when we're talking about it. So I'd ask council if that's okay, sure, if we kind of work on the messaging.
Yep. That's why I vote.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
So just two quick things.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Nixon.
Oh.
Go ahead.
So sorry.
Yeah, so I have a couple things as well. First of all, I probably could have done under council reports, but just a reminder that the SCA PIC meeting has been canceled for August, so we won't have to worry about that agenda. But we did get an email from SCA, which I forwarded to you earlier today, about an online survey that King County is conducting, asking for opinions on how the Veterans, Seniors, and Human Services levy money should be spent, assuming it passes in November. And they're starting to work on that implementation plan already. That online survey is open until August 11th. And I looked at it. It's only two questions, takes 5 minutes. Although they're free-form answers, so you can spend a lot of time on it if you want. But just to encourage folks to take a look at that and respond. Second item is some of you may remember three weeks ago, there was a lot of negative attention directed toward the Olympia City Council when one of their members proposed an ordinance that would make it a misdemeanor to disrupt the city council meeting. And it didn't pass, but it caused me to look at our council policies and procedures and realize we don't have any written policy on what we do if there's a significant disruption of a council meeting. And I asked Kurt to take a look at that, maybe stepping out of order a little bit. But I wanted to propose that we put on the task list for the Finance and Administration Committee to look at a potential policy addition that would talk about what do we do if there's a significant disruption of a meeting, what escalating measures we might have to deal with it. Would we physically remove disruptive people, or would we remove the council to another space? You know, those kind of things. Because I think it's better that those things be addressed in advance rather than in the heat of the moment. So we have it decided ahead of time. So that's my proposal.
Yes. Looks like the council is supportive of that.
Okay with that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Okay. And then the last thing is, on July 21st, we received an email from the Puget Sound Regional Council, and it highlighted Kirkland as having had a significant gain in population. Mm-hmm. And it actually showed that our population had increased 76.4% from 2010 to 2017. And several people in the community came unglued, because to them it was just complete validation of every concern they ever had about Kirkland growing too fast. But we all know, everybody's smiling, we all know that what really happened is we had an annexation of 31,000 people. And if you look at the OFM website, they actually publish adjusted base population figures whenever an annexation occurs. And so, I mean, if you OFM declares a population of Kirkland in 2010 that includes the annexation area, but PSRC didn't consider that. And our actual population growth was only 6.4%. So we would not have gotten that negative attention. And I thought about sending an email to PSRC myself saying, you just got this wrong and we're taking heat for it. But I decided I would raise it with you all first to see if you even think it rises to the level of wanting to complain.
Yeah. I think we knew that was going to happen.
Yeah.
I feel like they should have a little asterisk at the bottom on numbers like that and say, due to annexation. It's not really a difficult thing for them to do.
They mentioned it kind of separated from this huge graph that showed the big top 10 population growth cities in the state. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, I just thought I'd raise that. But if anybody brings that up and complains about how horrible we are for growing 76% in 7 years, it was really lying through statistics. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can't do anything about a ready, fire, aim mentality.
Yeah.
Last night, cleaned my brain
of
everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
So my two calendar issues
I
had that I wanted to ask is, as it was mentioned, the King County Council put the Veterans and Human Services Levy on the ballot officially, which they hadn't done in our last meeting, and I'm wondering if the council wants us to bring a potential resolution of support to a future council meeting for a discussion or not.
Yes, please.
Okay. All right, so we'll do that. And then secondly, this one I didn't have a chance to check in with the council about, but I wanted to let you know we've been working with Sound Transit and King County Metro and the state about exploring the Kingsgate Park and Ride for transit-oriented development, which we've listed as one of our priorities. What's come out of that work group is that they think we need a feasibility study to begin to define where the housing might go and what it might go. And so we have talked about the ability to maybe put in maybe up to $10,000 as a potential partnership in creating a feasibility study of the partners to get a little more definition around how a TOD might work there. And so my question was whether the council would be willing to have me bring back a proposal for council contingency for some money towards a TOD feasibility study into Kingsgate Park and Ride.
Why don't we ask Claudia to break out some of that Sound Transit money? There's money there for that.
There is, and we can certainly do that. And that was the concept, was maybe we have some seed money and everybody partners and we get a study done.
Yeah.
But so it wouldn't be fully funded by the city, right. But we'd try for partnership dollars. So I can bring one back, and then you can debate it. And
sounds good.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So that's all I have, Madam Mayor.
Thank you very much. The last item on our agenda is items from the audience. This is an additional time in our meeting when we hear from the public on matters which are not quasi-judicial or otherwise scheduled for public hearing. Please limit your comments to 3 minutes. We also ask that not more than three people speak on any one subject. However, if both proponents and opponents wish to speak, then up to three proponents and up to three opponents of the matter may address the council. This additional items from the audience period will not exceed 15 minutes. We don't have a sign-in sheet. Is there anyone who wishes to address the council at this time? You sure? Seeing none, I'll declare this items from the audience period closed. And thank you very much for a lot of work. Thanks for all sticking with us. We're adjourned. See you in September.
Yes.